01661 836 1338. That's 01661 836 1338. Here's the email, intouch@bbc.co.uk. Coming up in 5 minutes, Rumika Tanaka reflects on finishing the book her late mother had started writing about her samurai ancestry. That's in Heart and Soul in 5 minutes.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday the 23rd of August. This is Charles Carroll. Good morning. The Prime Minister is to give regional mayors across England greater powers over planning decisions. The change will mean they can direct councils to approve or refuse key local developments. Mayors will also be able to grant upfront planning permission so construction companies can start work on some projects without needing to apply. The Conservatives say local authorities are being stripped of their ability to make planning decisions. The Housing Minister, Matthew Pennycook, said that the measures had worked for Lord Carn as Mayor of London.
The tools that we're rolling out to other mayors, we know work. They're an essential part of the toolkit that mayors need to effectively deliver new homes and regeneration. That's why we're so determined to see them rolled out as soon as possible. New powers to call in strategic applications, to make development orders, and to introduce community infrastructure levies.
Serious sexual and violent offenders could be confined to areas of just a few miles after being released from prison on licence. The government hopes the restrictions will give victims the freedom to go about their daily lives without fear. The scheme will be introduced in England and Wales later this year. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
The intention to introduce restriction zones for violent offenders who leave prison and who are on probation was first announced by the government last year. The new Justice Secretary, Alex Norris, says these will now be introduced in October. Probation officers will be able to limit where serious offenders can go for as long as it's deemed necessary. Those who breach the new boundaries could be recalled to prison. This would go beyond the current practice of imposing exclusion zones, which ban offenders from specific locations, such as a victim's home or place of work. Mr. Norris is expected to come up with proposals to further restrict the early release of some prisoners when Parliament resumes next month. But the Conservatives say the best thing Labour could do to protect victims is to bring forward emergency legislation which would stop the early release of thousands of criminals.
A small power plant has been shut down during a cyber attack. The Sunday Telegraph said it was carried out last month by hackers affiliated to the Iranian regime. The government said that there was no risk at any point to the UK's energy system. Here's Tom Simons.
For security reasons, neither the government nor the National Cyber Security Centre, which deals with attacks on critical infrastructure, would give further details of the site affected. However, this was not an attack on an essential service, such as a large power station. The Department for Energy Security and Net Zero said the incident affected a small-scale generator, and at no point was there a risk to the wider energy system. The UK's power network has a number of smaller gas generators which provide short-term power when needed.
Investigators from the Independent Office for Police Conduct are reviewing evidence to determine the circumstances of a crash near Middlesbrough that killed two officers. Police constables Matthew Blades and Tom Clough died when a car travelling the wrong way down the A66 yesterday morning collided with their armed response vehicle. Five people in the car also died. Ukraine's former defence minister has used an interview with BBC News to reiterate his call for the country to hold wartime elections. In a video last week, Mikhailo Fedorov said that democracy could not be held hostage by Russia. A source in President Zelensky's office said a call for elections demonstrated a complete lack of realism. Mr. Fedorov, who was sacked last month, was asked whether he really believed sending people to the polls was in the interests of Ukraine and not his own.
It's definitely in my vested interest because I want this war to be over and Ukraine to become a successful country. So yeah, this is in my interest for sure. But of course, it's also in the interest of all Ukrainians. But if you're asking whether it will be useful for my political future, if I were thinking about this, I would not have made this statement.
The Trade Association for the Energy Industry is urging the government to introduce better targeted support for those struggling to pay for gas and electricity. A report by Energy UK says there needs to be a scheme that takes into account someone's income, health and energy consumption. More details from our business correspondent, Mark Ashdown.
Energy UK says 2.5 million customers who struggle with their energy bills don't qualify for the Warm Homes discount. Some face high energy usage because of medical needs or poorly insulated homes. The report recommends a more flexible social discount scheme that considers more factors and responds to price changes. The government said on top of the Warm Homes discount, it was cutting VAT on energy bills and would continue to work hard to shield consumers from energy shocks and bring down bills for good.
Mark Ashdown with that report. BBC News.
Charles Carroll, many thanks. Coming up in a moment, searching for Mother through her unfinished work. Then in half an hour, there's music on your farm as Kaz Graham hears the story behind a newly commissioned choral work celebrating sheep farming in the Yorkshire Dales. That's all ahead after this.
The intention to introduce...
Radio 4's Story of America.
New York City, please welcome... Joe Buck.
The first ever audio adaptation of Midnight Cowboy.
Say, I'm new in town, looking for the Statue of Liberty.
You for real?
Watch it, cowboy.
Go on, get out of here.
Dreams, desperation, and an unlikely friendship.
No, I don't like anything to do with stolen money.
Well, then you won't have anything to do with eating tonight either.
Midnight Cowboy.
No one's gonna stop us this time! We're getting out!
Begins this afternoon at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now on BBC Radio 4, time for Heart and Soul. And this week, Rimika Tanaka traces her family's samurai ancestry through an unfinished book left by her late mother. Can it bring her closer to the woman she never really knew?
My mother is magical. Ekemi had a magical aura around her.
She was very beautiful, like really beautiful, quite aloof, like not really knowable in some ways. Maybe that was actually part of her beauty thing, where you're like, well, you can't be real, so you're just distanced from them. Yeah, I just found her like magical and distant.
I like wearing kimono, and also kimono, oh, now it's April, I can wear this pattern of kimono and think about the season, and cherry blossom is beautiful now, so I can't wear cherry blossom kimono because my kimono cannot win the beautiful natural cherry blossom flower. So wearing kimono is wonderful. Think about nature, beauty.
Ekemi Tanaka, speaking there on BBC Radio London. Moved from Japan to England in 1995, making a name for herself as a Japanese language and cultural lecturer. As a descendant of the Tanaka samurai family, she was committed to keeping our ancestral traditions alive and had recently written a book called
The Power of Chōwa. Chōwa literally means harmony, but I wrote about searching for the balance in your life.
She was on a roll and had briefly mentioned to her daughter her plans to write a second book.
And then when she was wanting to start the project, she was diagnosed with cancer of the esophagus and it was really late stage. So, you know, sadly, like after the diagnosis, she died in about, you know, 4 or 5 months. So she never got to do that.
I'm sorry.
5 years after her death, on my 36th birthday, I got an email from her literary agent being like, Rimi, did you know what your mother's next book was going to be about? So I said, yeah, it was going to be about samurai culture. And this literary agent was like, well, do you want to pitch anything like that to us? Because we're looking for something. And I was like, is this real? I don't get what's happening. And so I replied, being like, yeah, I'm really interested. I'm a writer and I was just, you know, sending things off to magazines, often being rejected, writing loads of short stories. They didn't really get anywhere. And then within like 3 months, I had a pitch and a proposal and it was being sent around to publishers and it was my mother's idea. It felt like fated that I was called up to do something that I would love to do at that time. And it really felt like Ekemi's doing, because Ekemi is magical.
I'm Eloise Stevens, and in this episode of Heart and Soul, I follow one of my oldest friends, Rimika Tanaka, as an extraordinary opportunity sets her off on a path she would never otherwise have taken. In her book, Akemi wanted to focus on samurai women and how samurai beliefs could teach us how to live a fuller life today. But having grown up in the UK for most of her life, how does Rimi even begin to write this book? And can it bring her closer to her mother? Even though the samurai class was abolished in 1869, a stereotype prevails, all long swords and impressive armour. So who were they really?
Samurai were the military elite, and they practiced lots of traditional Japanese arts that still exist today. So apart from the sword fighting and the martial arts, samurai also did tea ceremony and ikebana, flower arrangement.
A core belief guides this intensive training, designed to develop rigour, self-belief and an inner calm.
Bunbu Ryodo is letteredness and martiality. It's the idea that you have to be balanced in your achievements. So you have to be good at academia as well as good at athletics. You can't be a meathead and you can't just be a geek. You have to be a mixture of the two.
And so Rimi sits down to delve deeper into the samurai.
How did you feel when you first started writing the book?
Really lost. I think I just wanted the book to be good. That's all I cared about. That would be enough to please Akemi.
And thinking about her mother, of course, is Rumi's first step towards understanding samurai beliefs.
My mum's dad's family, so my Oji-chan's side, is related to the Musashi warriors, going all the way back to Ota Dokan, who's a 15th century samurai lord. She practiced a lot of traditional Japanese arts, like sado, the tea ceremony. She even did like fan dancing. And when she practiced the traditional Japanese arts, because they're so tied up with samurai culture, she would have been taught in a similar way to like martial artists get taught to be disciplined.
But beyond that, Rimi can't really pin down what her mother might have believed.
I just really don't think I got to know my mother while she was alive, probably because she held a lot back from me, didn't talk about how she felt ever.
The two of them didn't spend a lot of time together either. As a child, Rimi felt her mother wasn't around very much.
My mother got divorced from my biological father when I was born. So then she was a single mum. You know, she didn't have any money, so she would have had to have a job.
When you came back home from the hospital, did you go straight to Oba-chan and Oji-chan's house? Your grandparents?
I imagine so. I don't really know. No one's ever told me about these times because they're so awful, I think.
Really?
Especially in Japan, where like shame culture is huge.
Do you think there was a lot of shame on Akemi?
Yeah, I think so. I think if someone divorces you, it's always the woman's fault.
I can tell Rimi is resisting dwelling on these times, but maybe it's because she was quite content. While her mother went to work as an English language teacher in a school nearby, Rimi spent long, happy days with her grandparents until the age of about 5.
I was meant to go to elementary school in Japan, and I didn't turn up. Then the head teacher called Oba-chan on the phone, and the head teacher said, "Your granddaughter's not here. Do you know where they are?" And Oba-chan was like, "I have no idea. Do you know where they are?" And he goes, "Well, I heard that they might have just left, but I don't really know." And so Oba-chan had to hear from the head teacher that her daughter had eloped with an Englishman and left to England with me. She just completely was so angry, I think, and then severed ties completely with Akemi for about 12 years.
Wow.
Rimi, Akemi and her new English husband flew to his parents' home in the remote islands of Orkney in Scotland.
It just felt like a really big piece of natural sea. There's no trees, it's just sea.
Mm.
Very windy. And Granny and Grancha, who are my English grandparents, they were there and they're really nice.
Do you remember your mum at this time?
Well, actually, no, because they left me there. My mum and my dad took me to Orkney, then left to Japan, I think. And I was just left there with Granny and Grancha.
They went back to Japan?
Yeah, or somewhere else, because I actually don't know where they went.
Now, I'm very excited about meeting my next guest, Akemi Tanaka. Welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Joe.
Over the next few years, Akemi travelled a lot, building a career as a Japanese lecturer and trying to make money for the household. Meanwhile, in Orkney,
everyone spoke English and not a word of Japanese, and everything was different from like the food to the TV shows, to the sounds, to the clothes.
It sounds like a lot for a young child to take on board.
So I just probably repressed my own emotions because I was like, well, this is it now. I have no idea what to really say. This is just the shock. And then you get used to it. But by the time you get used to having not really feeling your emotions, you just don't really feel them that much.
At the age of about 8, Rimi moved to Sussex in the UK with her mum and her mum's husband and went to a Christian school.
I think I took on quite a lot of Christian values, which were completely alien to Akemi growing up in Japan and living there, because Japan is not a Christian country. And I think maybe that's one of the biggest differences, honestly.
The one time Rimi did feel closest to her mother, though, was when Akemi hosted tea ceremonies for her.
The tea ceremony is not about just making a tea and drinking tea, but it's about creating the connection between host and guest through the stillness and mindfulness and share the time together. Ultimately, it's about creating inner peace. So what is inner peace to you?
It's not having many thoughts, I think, but more being aware of what's happening around my body.
That's a great answer.
Wanting to understand more about what her mother believed, Rimi visits Rei Seto Okablom, a Japanese tea practitioner, in her London studio.
In a tea ceremony, we follow four principles called Wake Seijaku, which is expressed in four Chinese letters. Wa means harmony, harmony with others, harmony with nature, and harmony with yourself. Kei means respect, respect for others and respect for yourself, and respect for every object you use, and respect for every people you meet. Sei means purity, not just keep the tea room tidy and clean, but also purify your heart and mind. And Jack means a tranquility. A lot of tea masters and tea practitioners talk about Ichigo Ichie. It's translated as one time, one meeting. But in a real meaning is this particular moment doesn't come back in the same way again. You might see these people over and over again, but in this situation and in this place, it will never happen again. So you want to cherish the moment and treat each other with respect and sincerity.
But these interactions between Rimi and her mother were, according to the art form, highly formalized.
The samurais have to leave their sword behind, otherwise they cannot come into the tea house. So there's no social distinct, and they only share the peaceful time and the bowl of tea. And you are expected to know the pattern of the conversation. For example, when you have the sip of the tea, the guest is supposed to say, "This is very delicious, thank you." And then after the session, the guests are supposed to make a compliment. "Oh, this is great tea bowl."
When you're doing the tea ceremony, it's like a play. People have to perform properly, otherwise the whole performance is just a little bit off.
Hey.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoying tea in this way was almost like a microcosm of their relationship.
We were never hanging out in a way that would create a sense of understanding between us through words. Sometimes I don't think we understood each other at all. Like the language we used, the way we felt, the expressions, they were just very different from each other. So that's why I felt like I never really got to know her.
Language is the principal lens through which Rimi understands the world. But as the project progresses, she realises it is not really serving her.
I reached this point in like all of my research and going to libraries and watching films and things where I was like, I don't think I'm really getting it, because the samurai didn't have a codified belief system. So there's not like a text or anything concrete that I can go to understand what samurai believed in. I was really focusing a lot on like letteredness, like gaining knowledge through books. And then I really kind of realised, well, I have to actually go do the practices, some of them at least, to understand what the samurai might have believed.
Okay, Rimi.
So we're on our way to take part in a samurai practice.
Where are we going?
going to see John Mackie Evans, who's a sword specialist and martial artist. He was actually a student of my mother's, a Japanese language student.
This sword martial art is called Batodo and is descended from the samurai's own sword practice.
Batodo literally means to draw and cut in order to function as a warrior in a life-threatening situation, or to cope with this principle that as a samurai you're prepared to give up your life for your lord. Yeah, well, you can do all the help you can get with coping with that.
And it is believed that this training was based on esoteric Buddhism and a practice called Shugendo.
Shugendo literally means the path of training and testing. You know, you can't, on the battlefield, sit down, focus on your breathing, and then get yourself all integrated. There isn't an opportunity to do that. So they have like a kind of incantations and mantras and hand positions, and you do these things in a very simple way, which brings everything together and allows you to enter that situation. Most of the syllabus, the practical stuff that they do, comes from Vajrayana Buddhism, which is, you know, the tantric tradition in India. So it's to do with the mandala, the mudra, and the mantra. So you have like a visual thing or a physical thing. So let's say in our case, it's your own body. You have the voice work, the way the voice connects to the energy. And then you have these intricate ways where you put the hands together to connect the energy together in the body. So you're bringing all of those things together. And that requires a lot of training. With the set. You forgot the set. We don't do full-on sparring because we're using live blades. The main practice is the form, which is a solo form.
Mm-hmm.
And in, let's say, two steps in, one inhale, one exhale, then there is that moment where you bring everything into that absolute decisive moment where you have to overcome both the fear of dying and the fear of killing, which is actually stronger in human beings.
Mm.
And then you have to become composed again. And that gives you, over time, a tool,
which in turn develops an indomitable quality.
Decisiveness. That's the role of a sword, cutting through material illusion.
That's a really good metaphor, if not actually just real.
Even though she was not a swordswoman, John believed that Akemi had that ability to be very decisive and influence her own fate.
I mean, she makes an instantly vivid kind of impression.
In Japan, one might say she was full of ki.
Ki or chi, everything has it. It's like a life force or an energy. And it sort of gets exchanged all the time between things and people and rivers or water.
The masters of ki and energy, they can attract and then they can just sever, you know. I think she had a bit of that. She was very clear what she wanted. If somebody's not going to cooperate, she's not going to waste her time.
It's funny because I wouldn't have described Akemi's magical aura as ki, but actually it probably is that, isn't it?
I think so. Well, a lot of it is, yes. Cut like a knife, I would say.
Mm. Talking to John, I don't think I had really connected how important cutting was as a metaphor for living in a way that's quite samurai, which is also the way Akemi lived. And it's not just about decisiveness. I think it's being very sure of yourself, like committing to an action. Because the way that John talked about it, you know, he's placing a lot of importance on the act because he is imagining that it is a life or death situation. And I think if you place that much gravitas behind your actions as well, you have to be very determined and absolute when you're doing these things. And I think mentally that's a very strong type of training.
This extreme mental discipline is earned by focusing intently on the body.
Where are my hands? How is my upper body positioned? Do the breathing.
Which is known as embodied knowledge. It is the idea that the body has its own intelligence, gained through muscle memory and physical interaction with the world. Akemi is likely to have honed this by practicing tea ceremony, which may have had a wider influence on the way she lived.
If she thought about something and said, I want to do this, she would just do it. If she was out of her depth, it didn't seem to make her doubt or afraid. She was just doing them already. So by doing them, she became an expert in them. And that's why I think she lived quite an embodied life.
Though Rumi thinks she will never live like this, samurai practices have brought her into our body in other ways.
What I realised is, like, I'd always placed a lot more importance on what I thought about and what I read and what I said, and not very much about how I lived my life or did things. That's probably why my emotions weren't as deep or as loud as they should have been. I think they were always a little bit turned down because I wasn't really fully feeling it with my whole body or my entire being. I was only feeling it with my mind. And so by doing practices like mindful movement or dance or martial arts, being quiet and doing stuff with your body actually allows you to feel emotions more loudly than the way I was living beforehand.
It's good. It's good. It's doing really well.
Thanks. No, it's fine. I hadn't really trusted the sword.
Okay. There was a point also in the Batodo where you're having to hold the sword blade towards yourself when you walk so as to protect everyone else but yourself. And the samurai obviously have to do this very extreme training to prepare to be killed and to kill. What did you make of that?
When I was researching the book, I realised that self-sacrifice was the ultimate form of duty. Samurai were always based upon serving duty to a lord. So I guess seeing it acted out in the idea of, like, you would sacrifice yourself for another if that was what was asked of you, I think is a very samurai thing.
Rumi thinks her mother felt a similar sort of sacrificial duty.
Akemi felt a sense of duty to do things rather than just, like, sit back and just watch things happen. So I think she had a benevolent form of duty to those who were in need. If she can help others, that's what she wants to do, which is why she set up the charity for the children left behind after the tsunami.
Akemi's charity was called Aid for Japan and was set up to help orphans after the 2011 tsunami in Japan. But even this attracted negative attention.
Unfortunately, in Japan, it is still quite sexist. So for a woman to be the head of a company or to be leading a charity is already seen as wrong or bad. But I think she just tried to ignore it and just, like, you know, raised her head higher and just carried on.
As Rumi got further and further into writing the book, she realised that the project was not just a means for her to fulfil her dream. Its resonance was much more profound.
When Akemi died, what was weird for me is that instead of feeling an absence of her, I just felt like she was present all the time now because she had become one of the ancestors. And it actually made me feel like I had a duty to continue her good work, but not in, like, a legacy-building way, more in a way that, like, so her and the ancestors would be proud of what I was doing in the realm of the living.
We're in the famous botanical gardens at Kew, on the outskirts of London, in a heatwave.
It's so hot and blustery.
We're here to pay respects to Akemi, Rumi's ancestor, by visiting her memorial tree.
Okay, I'm going to stop the compass, and I'm going to lead you to the tree, which is actually over that way.
Nice. And what kind of tree is it?
I think it's a Yamazakura, which is a cherry blossom tree that grows on the mountainsides.
Okay, beautiful.
The compass says this way.
Okay, let's go that way.
I think it's this.
Oh.
Yeah!
Oh my goodness.
I found it. There you go. Akemi Tanaka Pennington. There it is, the tree.
Yeah.
It's summertime, so it's just the leaves are all green. I think it blossoms in around May.
And what kind of flowers will it have?
Pink, like bright pink. Kind of like cloudy pink as well, like cloud white.
Stunning. Just like many people in Japan today, the samurai practiced ancestor worship. It had always been a part of Rumi's life, but it was only when her mother set her on the path of writing her book that she fully realised just how present the ancestors can be.
The thing about believing in ancestors
is that it's as much about the descendants as it is about the ancestors, because acts that happen now affect the feelings of the ancestors who are somewhere else, right? So people are acting responsibly in the past and in the future and in the present. It should all be like connected. When I studied anthropology, I heard a really good analogy from the Maori of New Zealand, where they also do ancestor worship. They said that we as individuals, it is like we're walking backwards into the unknown, whereas the ancestors are facing forwards, looking at us and what's behind us, because we don't know what's going to happen in the future, and yet we're blindly walking into it, right? But when you have ancestors, the ancestors can tell you what's ahead of you, because they're already looking forwards. And I like this spiritual way of viewing things, because, you know, if you believe in like a backing of people, you can also act more boldly and feel like your decisions aren't just like a one person thing. It's more of like a group thing.
Yeah, so you said that you felt a Kami spirit is everywhere and is guiding you. How do you feel that she has led you to this moment? Your book now is coming out into the world in a few months' time.
Nothing about this has been expected, and yet everything feels completely right, and I feel like that is such an Akemi way for things to happen. I couldn't have planned it any better. It just has happened this way. And in some ways, like, you've just got to like trust in yourself, but also trust in everything around you just working in some mysterious, magical way that only Akemi seems to have an overview of that I just don't.
Why do you think she wanted you to learn about samurai culture?
I don't have a way to really express my Japanese-ness, and I was fine with that. You know, I didn't mind that, but it's a bit sad as well to be cut off from a place where you were born. And I have my Obachan, who's 92, and I always think after Obachan dies, like, what will be my link to Japan? Like, I'll just be severed. I'll have to go back sometimes to look after the grave, but, you know, there's going to be nothing for me. Akemi's also gone. But now that I've written this book, and she's paved the way for me to write a book, and hopefully people will like it, and then they'll ask me questions about samurai in Japan, it's opened doors for me to actually continue my relationship with Japan in a way that's after her life. And, you know, to have a purpose like that is just so amazing.
Yeah.
I guess that her presence was enough to really shine and teach me something about a way to live.
And I think maybe she knew that you might not do that unless it coincided with your interest, which was writing.
Yeah, she probably did know that. Yeah, I mean, I'm glad it wasn't like a music album or something. I could do nothing.
Starting from scratch.
Yeah.
What would you say to Akemi now, standing here, learning all that you have in the writing of this book?
I don't know how you did it. Like, lived so fearlessly.
I also don't know how you raised a child on your own. And I guess I'm quite grateful for that. I think single mothers just have to, like, do a lot on their own, and it must be really hard. So she did a really good job.
Yeah, she did. She really did.
And then, like, that wasn't even her identity, right? She, like, went ahead and did way more than, I guess, people expected of her. And she owned it and was never apologetic about the way she was. You know, that's really brave. I really respect that.
Thank you, Akemi.
Yeah, thanks, Akemi.
Heart and Soul was presented and produced by Eloise Stevens. We've Choral Work celebrating sheep farming in just a moment. Then, in half an hour, we have Rural Recharge for Farmers, Bear Grylls, and football's religious roots. That's on our program Sunday at 10 minutes past 7 after the news and papers.
Music that moves you all summer long with the BBC Proms. From Bond and Beyond to the Miles Davis Centenary. And Elgar's Cello Concerto. The BBC Proms. Watch on iPlayer, listen on BBC Sounds.
Now on BBC Radio 4, On Your Farm with Kaz Graham.
Come on, don't be stopping. That's it. There you go, my dear. Come on. Come on, Bet. Well done, Bet.
These sheep are just going up a runway. They've got a wooden fence on one side and a big old dry stone wall on the other. What are you doing with them?
We've separated the sheep from the lambs. The reason for the big noise is that they don't like being separated. The family unit with sheep is quite strong. The sheep are quiet, the lambs are noisy. So what's going to happen now is we're going to put the sheep in the shearing shed, and hopefully today and tomorrow we'll finish the shearing process, and then they'll all be reunited by tea time tomorrow, and the noise will have gone. Calm will have restored.
I'm in the Yorkshire Dales today at Bleak Bank Farm near Ingleton. We've got the imposing flat-topped, almost table-shaped hill of Ingleborough, one of the really impressive Yorkshire Three Peaks rising up behind us. And it's this land, this upland farm, that John Dawson's family have worked for more than 100 years now. John, fine summer's day today. A great day for doing a bit of work with some sheep. Tell us a bit about the farm you've got here.
Yeah, so the farm is family-owned. It's about 300 acres. We're quite unusual nowadays in that we still have a small dairy herd of about 70 to 80 dairy cattle, plus their followers. And we lamb maybe 450 Dalesbred sheep. They are very similar to a Swaledale, except slightly superior in every way, as many people know.
Really? And your great-grandparents farmed here, didn't they?
Yeah, my great-grandparents came just after the First War. They had a son killed in the war. They decided to move farms for their other son, and so they came in 1920. They would graze on the common, as we do, on Ingleborough Common, which is 3,500 acres. And in a funny sort of way, the heritage bit means a bit, because those sheep in our yard that we can hear now in the background, they will share their heritage. It traces back to the Enclosure Acts of the 1750s, because it's never been broken. And when it was a tenanted farm, the tenant came in and they had to buy the sheep, because the sheep were hefted on Ingleborough, and they sort of belong to the farm. And the cattle are the same, really. It's an unbroken line. And it means a little bit to me, does the cultural heritage of the family farm.
Well, from what you're saying, I mean, it is hardly surprising that there's a really strong farming culture, a sense of tradition that these valleys are kind of steeped in. And it is the story of a magnificent celebration of this culture that's brought me here to your farm today, along with Margaret Coleman, who's chair of Lancliffe Singers, a choir based in, oddly enough, Lancliffe, a village just to the north of Settle, a few miles from here. Hi, Margaret.
Hello.
And also Vahan Salorian, who is a London-based composer of contemporary opera, operetta, song cycles and orchestral pieces that, I hope you don't mind me saying, get rave reviews.
Thank you very much.
That's all right. Now, one of your recent commissions, Vahan, was to do what?
To create a piece of music, a piece of choral music, that encaptured the farming life of the Yorkshire Dales, which is obviously a big, big ask for, you know, a like you say, a very historic, very culturally rich subject matter, also quite political as well. So, yeah, it's been the culmination of over a year's worth of kind of research and talking and writing to create this 16-minute choral song cycle that tells the story of a year in the life of a Yorkshire sheep farmer.
Margaret, you are the woman kind of behind this. Where did it all start?
Well, it started because Lancliffe Singers was celebrating its 40th anniversary in 2024, and we wanted to do something special to mark that anniversary. And so I got a group of people together from the choir and said, what should we do? And very quickly they said, we should commission an original piece, and then there's something for posterity, something that will, you know, remain an asset.
for people in the Dales. And then we said, well, what should it be about? Well, our whole area is just to do with farming, the culture, the landscape, the feeling that people have about living in our part of the Dales. So that was a no-brainer. And then I asked, which composer do you think we should approach? And as luck would have it, one of the folks I was talking to used to play woodwind with Vahan in Settle Orchestra. And she said, oh, we should ask Vahan Salorian.
Because you grew up around here, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Well, I grew up here. I went to school in Skipton, which is actually where I was best friends with my friend who did the words for this project.
What did you think when you were commissioned to write a piece about Yorkshire Dales farming?
I was really, really excited. So I like to do more unconventional things, works that are immersive or about subject matters that maybe haven't had classical music made about them. I've done an opera with BBC Four that was about being a single mum. I've done stuff in nightclubs and things. So this was exciting. And when we started doing the piece, we had no idea what it was going to look like. It's become this song cycle about a year in a farmer's life, but it was fully, fully open. It was shaped through the process.
And for autumn, you went along to Skipton Auction Mart for one of the big autumn sheep sales. They're quite a big event, aren't they, John?
They are the climax of the farming year, really. The autumn sheep sales are what make and break family farms.
Had you ever been to an auction mart before? What did you make of this?
It was incredible. It was quite an intense experience. And I came straight off the train from London, knowing that I was going to do some interviews with some farmers, thinking that maybe there'd be like a round table of people who'd volunteered to speak to me. And it wasn't that. It's they put a mic on me and said, go and talk to some people. So I just had to get some people talking. And it was hard work to begin with, and then actually once people started speaking, they loved it, and we had amazing conversations and already a lot of new information and useful information for the piece just on that first day, from all different age groups as well. We talked to a young mum, we talked to older farmers, and yeah, it was really, really interesting.
I have to say that the moment that Vahan was introduced to an auctioneer's patter, I knew it would have to feature somewhere in the piece. Yeah. And I was thinking, my goodness, the choir's going to have to sing this very fast. They're going to have to get their diction absolutely spot on.
You have these sections of the very fast patter of the auctioneer selling, and then it's meant to be the kind of chatter of the crowds and the farmers in the audience kind of gossiping and talking about the breeds that they prefer, and then it all layers up into something that's hopefully quite exciting and complex.
And I love the piece about Swaledales. Tell me, we're going to hear it in a minute. What was that like to sing, Margaret?
Oh, well, it's absolutely brilliant. It became a sort of earworm for most members of the choir. Though it's a beautiful lyrical piece, actually, and I sing soprano, and so there's this lovely kind of underlay of the scene of the auction being set up, and then the sopranos come in and say, nothing beats a Swaledale. And it's just a wonderful little phrase that a lot of us have just been singing over and over again.
Oh, the Swaledale is tremendous. We've been breeding them for years. They've done very well for us. You'll get a lot of shares. You can't go wrong with a Swaledale.
Oh, the Swaledale is tremendous. We've been breeding them for years. They've done very well.
We heard about the Swaledales first, and then that was the selling of a Dalesbread, complete with the auctioneer's gavel. I believe you had to buy a gavel, Margaret, is that
we
right?
We did. I think it must be the first piece that was actually scored for a gavel, and the conductor had tremendous difficulties conducting, and so in the end we had to bring in a gavel player, would you believe? But all for authenticity, it was very good.
Very, very hard to conduct with one hand and strike a gavel at the right time with the other hand. John Dawson, we are here on your farm today, Bleak Bank near Ingleton, and we've just moved over into the calf pens. Absolutely lovely. We've got a lot of little black and white calves in here, solid black one in front of us. And the reason you have calves is because you're not just sheep here, you've got a dairy herd too?
We do. We have a small dairy herd of about 80 cattle, and we've got all their babies growing up all the time. So many of these in here will be our future dairy cows.
And you helped with Vahan's research for this coral work. You invited him up here, along with a small group of other farmers, to talk about some of the ups and downs of farming. And I think that the price that farmers get for their milk was one of the downs, wasn't it?
Well, there's lots of downs in farming. If you want to make a lot of money, do something else. But yes, we talked about lots of ups and downs, and it was really good, because farmers are notoriously poor at sharing their thoughts, if you like. And so that was one of the things that has come out of this piece. And we spoke about ups and downs. We went right back to foot and mouth in 2000. We've talked about the weather. We talked about the milk price, which isn't good just now. But being a farmer, you're always optimistic. You can't farm at a place like Bleak Bank if you're pessimistic, trust me.
And why did you want to be involved in this project?
Because Margaret said I had to be.
I can understand that.
Well, I think anything that puts the family farm in people's faces has to be done. And this is a real opportunity to do that. And I think the way it was talked about before it was performed at Settle, round the auction marts, in the auction cafes, in the auction mart car parks, generally in the vets, places like that, I think it's fantastic because it just raises the profile of what farmers do.
Can people make a living round here from farming?
Yes, yes. Farming gets into your soul. It fills the whole of your being. And I love that. I still consider myself lucky not to be commuting to Manchester or London. I'm out of the house and I'm at work. Now, I'm not going to make a lot of money. If we sold everything, we could clear the bank loans and things like that. But you don't want to do that. It's the lifestyle that I enjoy. It's working with animals. It's working with dogs. It's the challenges of the weather. It's the whole thing, apart from the government, which I enjoy. Doing something that's actually worthwhile.
Vahan, you live in London nowadays. I mean, was some of what these farmers were saying to you, was it a bit of an eye-opener, really?
I think it definitely was. We had the streets being closed in London where the farmers protested about the new tax system on land, say. And I didn't know a lot of the details about that. And I know, as a left-wing leading person, what my friends and what we thought of that policy, thought, oh, what are these people doing down here moaning about this? They've got all these estates and all this kind of stuff. And that was around about the time when we first started doing the interviews. I got all this information back of the fact that, you know, that farmers, like John said, are land rich, but that is all tied up in the industry that they have and the life that they lead and their families and everything as well. So even just a thing like that was very eye-opening.
Now, John, this farm is called Bleak Bank Farm. Does it get quite bleak up here?
It gets very bleak. It's bleak by name and bleak by nature sometimes. We're at 850 feet in the yard now, so we're quite well above sea level. We get a lot of the westerly weather, a lot of the rain. We get the easterly winds.
Vahan, you wanted to capture in the second movement of the piece this idea of winter. It's really different from the first piece, which is all autumn and boisterous and full of life. What was the idea for you behind this second piece?
So I love folk music. I played it a lot growing up around here as well. So I wanted to create a new folk song for like a Yorkshire winter environment. It's meant to be quite moving. Yeah, and I think it came off pretty well.
Across the fields, the sheep now roam. Over the hills, they're going home. It's growing cold, the sun descends. We feel the chill. Thank you.
just love that kind of spiky plucking of the strings there. It's just so evocative of the ice, isn't it? We're just walking up through the yard now, and we're just passing by your son William. John, he's shearing.
We're doing the last of the fell sheep today. They've all got twin lambs, these, so they get done last because they've had a hard summer, and this is William's job for today.
He's clipping. He's got the shearers out. He's got a big red tub of paint that he's going to be marking that sheep with afterwards.
Yeah.
Are those bags at the back, what are they?
Those are full of wool, and they'll go to the wool board in the next few weeks, really, hopefully. And that'll be that for another season. And then we roll on in, before you know what you're doing, you're rolling into the sheep sales again. You've gone full cycle once more.
The shepherd's year.
The shepherd's year. Everything is just the same every year, except totally different.
Okay, let's make our way up here because we're heading up the yard and we're going to head up the hill a little. And while we're on our way walking up there, we just heard the orchestra plucking those strings to make that lovely, icy kind of noise. It was a real community project, this. Tell me about the orchestra, Margaret.
Oh, well, the orchestra is Settle Orchestra, which is our local amateur orchestra. And they were so keen to collaborate with us. It was excellent. We were calling in favours from all over the place, from Settle Orchestra, from local farmers, from Skipton Auction, from the local primary school. And it was just so wonderful that everybody was prepared to contribute something.
And tell me about the school, because you went and worked in the local primary school, didn't you, Vahad?
Yeah, so we worked with Year 4 and 5 from Settle Primary. I went in and gave two workshops to them, just explain the piece to them, talk about being a composer as well, hoping that they would want to come and also watch the concert. And it was lovely. I am an educator in music down in London, and I said to Margaret, it was wonderful working with some northern kids for a change as well. And they were lovely. They were super enthusiastic. A lot of them came from farming families, so they had some really interesting insights as the new generation of farmers into farming life that contributed to the project.
And what kind of words did they come up with? What were their kind of lyrics?
So the final movement of the piece, and actually the whole of the work, is inspired by a folk song called Country Life, which was collected by this folk group from a farmer in Wensleydale originally. And so I knew I wanted this to be at the core of the whole piece, but I wanted the children to make their own lyrics, especially the children who came from farming families, to talk about what their farming year and what their life is, you know, through spring, summer and autumn. And each verse in this folk song describes a different season, just like this piece does as well.
And in summer, they talk about eating ice creams, swimming in the local swimming pool.
Yes. So we didn't keep them completely on the farming tangent, but I think that's all they could really think about in the summer holidays, which is fair enough, isn't it?
I like to burn the lambs on the pit, listen to the sound of the baby bird.
How important was it for you, Margaret, to get those young voices involved in the project?
Oh, really important, because it's quite important, I think, to think about the generations that are coming next and their sense of place and their sort of sense of belonging on the land and so on. And the children sang with such gusto. The sound that they made, it brought tears to our eyes the first time we heard it, because it was just beautiful. And of course, we're making a film about it, the whole of the project, and that we're going to show later on in the year. And all of the footage is going to go into the Folly Local Museum in Settle.
And the whole collaboration culminated in a performance at Settle Parish Church. What was that like?
It was absolutely astonishing. It was a complete sellout, and there was such a wonderful mood and atmosphere there. The cheers and the applause and the foot stamping at the end was just something to behold. It was just incredible.
Oh, and what did you make of it, John?
Well, I don't have a musical bone in my body, but I never went to sleep all evening. I thought the...
What you mean, when you were actually at the performance?
At the performance. I can sit down and go to sleep anywhere. But to go into a church that had standing room only and to sit there and just let this whole project wash over you, it was fantastic. Such an experience. It was so emotional. It was almost brought you to the brink of tears, some of it.
It was a real success. And it's hard, obviously, when you've written the thing to say that it's really emotional and successful, because you don't want to sound big-headed. But it was really beautiful. And I think, yeah, for me as well, it's the moment when the children start singing and the choir joins in. And it ends with these beautiful words that my mate and my librettist, the guy who writes all my words for, wrote a really, really poignant message about farming life and the future and the land that we love. And that bit definitely got me a little bit choked up. It was a really, really lovely evening.
Well, I want to end this programme with those words and that particular final piece of the music. So I am going to say thank you very much now to Margaret Coleman from Lancliffe Singers, composer Vahan Salorian, and also to John Dawson. Thank you so much for welcoming us all here at Bleak Bank Farm today. The closing words of this piece, they're so evocative and timeless. And before we hear them performed by the choir, John, could you read them to us just so that they don't get lost?
I certainly can, yeah. This is the land of peace and plenty, where lambs are born and food is grown. We tend to it while we are here. When we are gone, you need not mourn. Our work is done. Now we may rest inside the land we love the best. Inside the land we love the best.
Farm was presented and produced by Kaz Graham. It was a BBC Audio Bristol production for Radio 4. Coming up later this morning on Sunday Worship, as the city fills with performers, Father Philip Blackledge looks at adopting different personas and hiding behind masks, with music by members of the Edinburgh Festival Chorus. Sunday Worship is at 8:10. Now let's turn our thoughts to today's weather and say good morning to Sarah Keith-Lucas.
Good morning to you, Neil. We had a bit of rain through last week, which broke the prolonged dry spell. But actually, this weekend has seen another dry window in the weather, and that continues today. So we're looking at another fine, settled, dry day pretty much across the board, with high pressure centred right across the UK. Now, across England and Wales today, it's quite a fresh start to the day, but lots of blue sky, lots of sunshine this morning. Heading into the afternoon, we'll tend to see a little bit more fair weather cloud just bubbling up in places, and it may bring a passing shower to the very far southeast, particularly for Kent. But for the rest of us, it is going to stay dry, light winds, and it'll feel pleasantly warm with temperatures between about 21 to 25 degrees north to south. Scotland and Northern Ireland will see a little bit more cloud, particularly towards the northwest, and it's thick enough to bring some drizzly showers to parts of the Western Isles, Highland, the north coast of Northern Ireland also seeing a few showers, whereas further south across Scotland and Northern Ireland, it's drier with some sunny spells and temperatures generally around 17 to 20 degrees here. Now through tonight, it stays dry and clear. The cloud that we've got today across Scotland will just drift its way off towards the north. So with those clearer skies, it'll be a touch cooler across Scotland and Northern Ireland than it was last night. So temperatures overnight for most of us getting down to between about 7 to 10 degrees. But it could be locally down to just a few degrees above freezing in the countryside. That means a fresh start to Monday too, and it's more of the same tomorrow. High pressure still in charge, so another dry day. Again, lots of sunshine, a bit like today. But the difference into tomorrow, we'll start to see a brisk easterly breeze developing in the south. That'll take the edge off the temperatures for London and the southeast, for instance. Warmest places somewhere further west. Wales, for instance, could be 25, 26 degrees in the south. And Northern Ireland and Scotland also seeing temperatures in the low 20s tomorrow. And then things change a little as we head through towards the middle of the week. We'll start to see low pressure moving in from the southwest. So we could well see some heavy showers and some thunderstorms, particularly from Wednesday to Friday.
Explore moments of modern history with me, Kirsty Wark.
All I could think of is that I hadn't been sacked, so I must be doing something all right.
Meet the people who brought Casualty to our screens 40 years ago. Revisit two landmark Scottish films from the 1980s.
I'm so jealous I wasn't in Local Hero.
And first, relive the Isle of Wight Festival, one of the biggest music events of the 20th century.
Well, it looked like a medieval encampment on the eve of a great battle, and it was incredibly spectacular.
That's The Reunion on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starting this morning at 10.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 23rd of August. Good morning, this is Charles Carroll. Regional mayors in England are to get a greater say about whether to approve major housing and business developments. Prisoners released on licence could see their movements restricted to areas of just a few miles. And a small power plant was shut down after reportedly being targeted by hackers linked to Iran. The Prime Minister is to give regional mayors across England greater powers over planning decisions. The change would mean they could overrule local councils and, for some large-scale projects, grant upfront planning permission for developers. The Conservatives say the government is stripping local authorities of their ability to make planning decisions. Our political correspondent Shelley Phelps reports.
The plans would give all elected mayors in England the same powers over planning the Mayor of London currently has. Decisions over projects deemed important for local growth, such as large housing or commercial developments, could be taken out of the hands of local councils and be made by regional mayors. They would also be able to charge a levy on successful planning applications in order to fund major infrastructure projects, as was used to help pay for the new Elizabeth line in the capital. But even with his enhanced powers, Sadiq Khan has missed London's reduced targets for affordable housing. The Housing Minister, Matthew Pennycook, said despite that, they were important tools that had worked and would allow mayors to set the strategic direction of their area.
Serious sexual and violent offenders could be confined to areas of just a few miles after being released from prison on licence. The government hopes the restrictions will give victims the freedom to go about their daily lives without fear. The scheme will be introduced in England and Wales later on this year. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
The intention to introduce restriction zones for violent offenders who leave prison and who are on probation was first announced by the government last year. The new Justice Secretary, Alex Norris, says these will now be introduced in October. Probation officers will be able to limit where serious offenders can go for as long as it's deemed necessary. Those who breach the new boundaries could be recalled to prison. This would go beyond the current practice of imposing exclusion zones, which ban offenders from specific locations, such as a victim's home or place of work. Mr. Norris is expected to come up with proposals to further restrict the early release of some prisoners when Parliament resumes next month. But the Conservatives say the best thing Labour could do to protect victims is to bring forward emergency legislation which would stop the early release of thousands of criminals.
A small power plant has been shut down during a cyber attack. The Sunday Telegraph said it was carried out last month by hackers affiliated to the Iranian regime. The government said that there was no risk at any point to the UK's energy system. Here's Tom Simons.
For security reasons, neither the government nor the National Cyber Security Centre, which deals with attacks on critical infrastructure, would give further details of the site affected. However, this was not an attack on an essential service, such as a large power station. The Department for Energy Security and Net Zero said the incident affected a small-scale generator, and at no point was there a risk to the wider energy system. The UK's power network has a number of smaller gas generators which provide short-term power when needed. Protecting the country's supplies is a key challenge for the government. It's updating its regulations for cybersecurity and working on a new energy resilience strategy for later this year.
A stretch of the A66 remains closed this morning after a crash that killed 7 people, including 2 Cleveland police officers. Our reporter Philippa Goymer is at the scene.
A police cordon remains in place on a stretch of the A66 between Middlesbrough and Redcar after yesterday's early morning crash. A response vehicle being used by police constables Matthew Blades and Tom Clough was hit by a Volkswagen Passat travelling in the wrong direction. The road closure will be in place for several more hours while investigations by the Independent Office for Police Conduct continue. The identities of those travelling in the Passat has not been confirmed, but the BBC understands they were all young men in their late teens and early 20s from the local area. The IOPC is expected to confirm their names later today.
Ukraine's former defence minister has reiterated his call for the country to hold wartime elections, but stopped short of saying that he would stand as a candidate. Mikhailo Fedorov, who was sacked last month, has been speaking to our Ukraine correspondent, Dan Johnson.
Mikhailo Fedorov enjoys popular support after reshaping Ukraine's armed forces. Protesters called for his reinstatement until his push for elections. He told me it was his moral right to start that conversation, saying a vote was inevitable sooner or later.
It's definitely in my vested interest because I want this war to be over and Ukraine to become a successful country. So yeah, this is in my interest for sure. But of course, it's also in the interest of all Ukrainians. But if you're asking whether it will be useful for my political future, if I were thinking about this, I would not have made this statement.
For now, Mikhailo Fedorov said he would continue to pursue new ways of fighting the war and would visit the United States, hoping to meet Elon Musk, with the aim of getting use of the Starlink satellite communications network extended to Russian airspace to support Ukrainian long-range attacks without benefiting Moscow.
The Trade Association for the Energy Industry is urging the government to introduce better targeted support for those struggling to pay for gas and electricity. A report by Energy UK says there needs to be a scheme that takes into account someone's income, health and energy consumption. More from our business correspondent, Mark Ashdown.
6 million households are eligible for the Warm Homes discount, but Energy UK says 2.5 million customers who struggle with their bills don't qualify. Some not only have low incomes, but also face high energy usage because of medical needs or poorly insulated homes. The report recommends a more flexible social discount scheme that considers more factors and responds to price changes. The latest projections suggest the energy price cap for October could reach a 3-year high, while the number of people in energy debt is already at a record high. The government said on top of the Warm Homes discount it was cutting VAT on energy bills and would continue to work hard to shield consumers from energy shocks and bring down bills for good.
A piano and a microphone used by Freddie Mercury, along with early drafts of his songwriting, are expected to fetch hundreds of thousands of pounds at auction in October. The Yamaha C3 grand piano was played extensively by the Queen frontman while composing some of the band's biggest hits, including Crazy Little Thing Called Love. Well, that's the news this morning. Now a look at the Sunday papers. The Sunday Times this morning says Russia has withdrawn its ambassador to the UK without naming anyone to replace him, prompting fears that there's been a downgrade of diplomatic relations between the two countries. The paper suggests the removal of Andrei Kelin, who's been ambassador for 7 years, is part of a bid to force Britain to reconsider its support for Ukraine. Will she, won't she, asks the Sunday Telegraph, as the paper reports that the Duchess of Sussex's return to acting has been thrown into uncertainty. The Sun on Sunday claims a £1 million deal to appear in The Gentlemen is off. The paper is among a number to quote the writer Tina Brown, who claims the casting offer has been withdrawn because of an intense backlash against Meghan Markle in the UK. The Duchess of Sussex has been approached for comment. The Mail on Sunday says a poll of 2,000 people shows that just 4% of Britons believe the Prince of Wales should be the one to make the first move in peace talks with his brother, the Duke of Sussex. 27% of people think that they should make amends equally together. In its editorial, the Mail says that it's vital the brothers do reconcile for the sake of the monarchy and their sick father. The Sunday Telegraph has more details of what it calls the unprecedented cyber attack on a British power plant. The paper understands it was carried out by Iranian-backed hackers at the same time as a series of attacks on wastewater plants which affected 12 states in the US. The UK attack is thought to be the first time hackers affiliated with Tehran have succeeded in closing down such a facility in Britain. The government said the UK had a highly resilient energy sector. According to the Sunday Times, 10 of England's mayors have already backed Andy Burnham's plans to give them more powers to overrule councils on house-building projects. The Prime Minister tells the paper the policy will enable mayors to overcome what he calls NIMBY councils, which refuse permission for much-needed new homes. But the Sunday Times leader asks, how will Burnham manage the backlash from communities adamantly opposed to certain initiatives? And many of the sport back pages have some fun highlighting Manchester United's bad start to the new Premier League season, losing their opening game 2-0 to Hull. Humbled on Humberside, declares the Sunday Express. The Mail on Sunday says United took one Hull of a beating, while the Sun on Sunday suggests Michael Carrick's team went to Hull and back. I'll look at some of Sunday's papers.
Charles Carroll, many thanks. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 7:10. Time now for Sunday with William Crawley.
Thanks very much. Good morning. On the eve of Independence Day in Ukraine, the Ukrainian Catholic Bishop in London talks to us about what it's like to be a church of exiles.
The diaspora, although certainly feels to be British, but we retain our cultural and religious and spiritual connections with our homeland.
Also coming up this morning, with the Premier League season now underway, we will explore the spiritual history of the beautiful game and Bear Grylls on finding faith in the wild with the cast of The Chosen.
My kids said to me once, they said, Papa, you've taken Obama into the wild and Prime Minister Modi. Just imagine if one day you could take Jesus.
As ever, your emails to sunday at bbc.co.uk. We're on social media at bbcr4sunday. Church buildings across Britain are in trouble. Repair bills are climbing into the millions. Congregations are shrinking. Many historic parishes simply cannot cope. But could there be a possible answer from abroad? In Germany, for example, a church tax brings in well over 12 billion euros every year, even as people are leaving the church in record numbers. Liberty Phelan from the Sunday team has been taking a look for us.
Church taxes exist in quite a few European countries. Generally, it's a voluntary tax that funds the work of religious institutions, but it works in different ways in different places. For example, in Iceland, the tax can go to any religious group and even the Humanist Society if you like. If you have no religious affiliation, you still have to pay it and it goes to the treasury instead. And in Spain, you can give the tax to the Catholic Church or a charitable fund or both or neither. Germany collects a tax from members of the Protestant and Catholic churches as well as a few other religious groups. If you opt out, you can't have a wedding, baptism or funeral in the church. Increasing numbers of people have been opting out. More than 650,000 members left those churches last year. But here's where the so-called miracle comes in. The amount of money they're collecting still keeps going up. The churches collected about 12.5 billion euros last year, which is slightly more than in 2024. This appears to be because the wages of church members are rising. The money is taken as a percentage of their taxable income.
So that's what they're doing in various European countries. Could the UK borrow the idea? Simon Jenkins is former editor of The Times, the author of many books, including most recently Cathedrals, Masterpieces of Architecture, Feats of Engineering, Icons of Faith. He's a supporter of a UK version of the church tax. Simon, good morning. Welcome to you.
Good morning. Hello.
Obviously, tax is not exactly a popular idea, Simon, at the best of times. Why imagine that it could work in the UK?
Well, can we start with the, I hate the word crisis, but as you said at the beginning, in the centre of almost every English community, village, town, city, there's a large often beautiful building standing idle. It's empty almost all the time. It's unused. It's beautiful. It can't be demolished. It's sitting there demanding someone spend some money on it. And what I'm saying is the answer has got to be localism. It's got to go to the local people who after all, built it originally in the Middle Ages. Half of all listed historic buildings in Britain, grade one listed buildings, are now churches, and they're in trouble. The only way of solving it, because the church can't afford to and the state won't, is to put them in the hands of the local people. This happens in almost every other country in Europe. Now, the church tax is something that all other countries, they've really inherited from the Middle Ages, and we banned ours when we separated church and state. But nonetheless, the option's there. There's a solution to this problem. Mm. It's just got to require someone to have the guts to do it.
Let me ask you about carrots and sticks then. If there was a church tax in the UK, would you go as far as the German model, where you're not allowed to have a wedding in a church unless you pay it?
Well, yes, I think I would. I mean, these buildings, to most people, the church has some use. It has some purpose. All I'm saying is that use and purpose should be extended far more widely, particularly as other local activities are declining in villages and towns, particularly in high streets. The church is sitting there waiting to be used. The purpose of the church tax in most countries is simply to maintain their most valued local building. And in many countries, it is voluntary. I can't see what's wrong with a voluntary tax. You can cross it out and not pay it. There's no big problem. What's extraordinary is that even in countries with very low church attendance, like Denmark, most people still pay the tax. They're proud of their local church. I think we should be.
Some of the critics of this approach will say, Simon, look, if you look at the Church of England, it has a multi-billion pound endowment. Why should people be asked to fund an institution that many would say is far from poor?
Because that money is being used for religious purposes. It's for paying the clergy. Most of these buildings are really not any longer religious buildings. They're simply sitting there in the middle of a community. They're dark, they're gaunt, they're unused. It seems to me tragic. You enter an English village and the only bit of the village that's got no life in it is around the church. There's no problem here. It can be solved. The church should be vested in the local parish council. The local parish council should take it over, as it does a sports pavilion or a museum or whatever it might be, and make it its responsibility and charge people to keep for its upkeep. I repeat, they don't have to pay. It's a voluntary activity. We can't get off our backsides in this country and do these things that other countries now do.
If a tax like this were to be introduced, how would you make sure that it was fair to other faiths? I know you're focused particularly on heritage, rich cultural heritage, but in other parts of Europe, this kind of revenue is shared widely, even beyond buildings.
Well, it isn't in many countries. I mean, I think in Italy and in Iceland, you can nominate a different charity from the local church. That's not really the issue. I mean, local parishes, they support other buildings locally. They start supporting their church. The most outrageous thing is that the government taxes church repairs 20%. They charge the VAT on church repairs 20%. It doesn't charge VAT on any new building. It just charges VAT on anyone who dares to repair a church. I just can't believe how backward we are in all this.
Would you be concerned at all that a tax like this, and that I think they've seen this in Germany, could have the unintended consequence of raising wages?
I don't think it has. I think that's not nothing to do with wages. I really don't think it's to do with it. The question is, what are you prepared to support as a community? And you support your sports activities, you support your old people's clubs and so on. Just support your local church. It's your finest building. And find new ways of using it. Don't build new town halls or new sports halls. Use the church. It's sitting there waiting to be used. And we just got to find a way of doing it. And we seem trapped at the moment. I may say the church is no help. The church imposes terrible restrictions or severe restrictions on the use of churches. I think they should actually be, in effect, secularized and used for all kinds of activities, particularly things like pubs, post offices, bookshops, and so on. A lot of them are used this way already, but not many of them.
Simon, thank you very much. Simon Jenkins. Farming can be one of the loneliest jobs in Britain. Men who work the land are twice as likely to take their own lives as the national average, with rural suicide rates the highest of any community type. That's according to Farmers Weekly. Now the Methodist Church in West Devon has launched a rural recharge. It's a new men's support group which offers farmers pizza nights, fishing trips, friendship and a place to talk. Frank Glanville, who's a farmer, told us why it's needed.
I'm afraid I have seen too many people within the countryside that have had serious mental issues and have taken their lives, let's be honest about it. And if we can help those that are getting close to that point and give some encouragement that, you know, there is the light at the end of the tunnel, as it were, and we can work together and perhaps thrash things through, and, you know, it's not so bad as it seems. But it's sometimes just the little things that push people over the edge. It's not that one big thing. It's lots and lots of little things that play on people's minds. And, you know, you've got to be just there to try and listen and talk things through.
We can talk now with the Reverend Chris Jackson, Superintendent Minister of the West Devon Circuit. Chris, good morning.
Good morning.
Why does faith, Chris, feel like the right starting point for tackling something as practical as money worries, loneliness and the like?
I think the word that I like to use with this is community. I think faith provides community for people, an opportunity to actually get together and be with others.
So what happens then on a typical rural recharge evening? What would I see if I walked in?
I'm going to say, I'm not sure there's a typical one. It depends on which type you're in, because we have two sides to this.
I'm looking for a barn dance.
You're looking for a barn dance. Okay. Well, you would come in. You know, okay, we had a barn dance. We have lots of people. We'd have music. And you would just come in and be very, very welcomed with food, with conversation, with people that, when I say people that you know, people that you do know within the community, but you don't meet very often. And I think that's one of the key things, is that opportunity to actually be with others.
I think everybody can understand the importance of community and the importance of safe space, a fun space, to open up and have a conversation. But pastorally speaking, are you being extra vigilant as well? What if you notice something or hear something that makes you think we need to go further than just a chat here at the minute? I need to intervene.
I mean, we've got a group of people that are trained into looking for people that may be either suffering from depression. We've had suicide prevention training for a number of us, and we will have those conversations. We will be having our eyes and ears open amongst the conversations that we're having with people, and we will respond in a positive way.
And so that might mean trying to coordinate a meeting beyond that evening, in the following week or later.
Yeah, very much so. And actually, when you say the following week, often it's actually immediately.
Immediately,
we think things are serious. But yeah, absolutely, we will have follow-up meetings and conversations with the staff that run this. And so we're very proactive in looking after the community that we are creating,
So you have some men-only events. You also have some family events? Yeah.
Well, we do actually, and not under the Rural Recharge banner, but one of my colleagues, Sarah Ballston, is one of the driving forces behind the Rural Recharge, and she works primarily with the families and the children. What we actually found, because we do holiday clubs, we do something called Stay and Play Out and Abouts, what we found was most of the people that came to that were the mums or the grandmums. With the children. What we found, the people that were missing out were the men, because actually they were generally out in the field on their own.
Chris, you've said, I think, that faith has faded on the surface in some cases in your experience pastorally, but you still sense something deeper in the farmers who come along. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think in the, and I do mean in the past, a lot of the churches and the chapels were actually deeply held by the local communities. It was a central place where things happened. They built many of the communities in the rural areas or provided funding for it. That hasn't really gone away, although it may not be seen on in church on a Sunday. Yes, we all know that there's declining numbers in one respect on a Sunday. But what we've actually found, and again, working as a rural minister, slightly different from an urban minister, I have worked in urban, but what you find is the respect for the church and Jesus and God and faith is often stronger, because I think they've realized that need to connect both to the building where families have been married, christened, buried. It's actually incredibly important as a central point of faith, as an anchor there for them.
I was just thinking of the word anchor as you were talking, Chris. Yeah. And if local communities lose that anchor, a lot follows.
Yes, I'm well known for somebody that doesn't actually close churches generally, because I think it's finding a way to keep a church open. Because when you close a church, in particularly in a rural community, sometimes it can be that removal of something quite tangible that actually does, as we say, anchor people, and it can cause quite a lot of damage when we close them. So we try not to.
Chris, thank you very much. The Reverend Chris Jackson, Superintendent Minister of the West Devon Methodist Circuit. And if you've been affected by any of the issues we've just been talking about, there is information about support that's available for you on the BBC Action Line. That's at bbc.co.uk/actionline. Its liturgy is unchanged since it began in the middle of the 5th century, but the Coptic Church is reporting what it describes as exponential growth, at least in part attributed to one of our society's most modern innovations, the ubiquitous social media platforms. One of the more recent branches of Christianity to establish itself in the UK, the Coptic Church, or the Egyptian Orthodox Church, celebrates 50 years here this year. Yet the Coptic Church itself claims to be the oldest of all churches, founded around 25 years or so after the death of Jesus by St. Mark, the writer of the Gospel bearing his name. Our reporter Naomi Wellings visited their mother church in the United Kingdom. It's also the first Coptic church in Europe as a whole, St. Mark's in London's Kensington.
The same words used by worshippers just decades after the death of Jesus. The same heady aroma of incense. The same warm, yeasty smell rising from the kitchens as the golden, round Eucharist breads are freshly baked.
We believe in one holy, Catholic, and apostolic church. We confess our baptism for the forgiveness of sins. We look for the resurrection.
Father Anthony Aziz is proud to have kept intact what he views as St. Mark the Evangelist's own church.
All the way through to this present day, we have preserved those teachings, we've preserved those liturgical practices. And so by preserving that, we have something that is of great value and something that is of great theological depth and is presented beautifully. Then if people see that through social media, they would like to experience that for themselves.
He believes it's through a large presence on the internet, apologetics, sermons, prayers, that many have found faith and been drawn to orthodoxy. Over the past few years, inquiries about baptism have significantly increased.
From being one every 2 or 3 weeks, it'll be one every 2 or 3 days. And we'd realise that we as parish priests and servants of the church would run out of capacity to do individual one-to-one catechism.
And so they set up online classes. Now run every 6 months, these cater for around 100 people, many coming from different faith backgrounds and other Christian denominations.
I was in a completely different part of England, and still God found a way for me to be on the catechism course in London because they would do it online.
People like Talitha, her baptismal name, born and brought up in a devout Muslim family, she rejected the faith at 19, becoming an atheist, before a Christian flatmate she vigorously debated with helped her start her Christian journey.
It wasn't until a year after, when I was like, okay, I want to make this official, that I realised if I want to get baptised, I would need to find a church to baptise me.
A chance meeting with a work colleague opened the door to the Coptic Church.
I remember walking up to my seat. I had no idea what was going on, but I walk up to my seat and I look up and I see the icon of Christ's baptism just looking back at me at the place where I was seated, and I just knew that was confirmation that I was to be in the Coptic Church. just feels like you're sort of singing and praising with the angels, with all the saints who have gone generations and generations before you, to be singing the same hymns as people who were there 2,000 years ago. It's such a powerful feeling. It makes you feel like part of something bigger.
24-year-old Guilherme had been an atheist. Looking for meaning in life, he started searching on social media 3 years ago.
It's very surprising to see the amount of young people, especially, that are coming to find religion as a whole, but especially Orthodox Christianity, not just here in the UK, but we also see the same surge in the USA, through social media. And I think we definitely have to attribute that to the Holy Spirit working within people's hearts.
And while migration has undoubtedly played its part in swelling the numbers in the church, along with the active youth and student movement, Archbishop Angelus of the Diocese of London is convinced that what he describes as exponential growth is crucially a result of fresh interest from those without any background in the Orthodox Church.
It's a wanting to be grounded in a more historic and deeper form of Christianity, both in the teaching of the fathers, but also in basic Christian values, of family values, of, you know, moral and ethical values. You will find some evangelical Christians who have that, but then they recognize that Christian teaching goes back before the Reformation, and they start tracing those steps, and they find roots. They are exposed to the fathers and exposed to early Christian thought, and that makes a difference.
Archbishop Angelos is giving prizes to the Sunday school, wearing his golden mitre and a flowing white cassock with an embroidered scene of Jesus as shepherd on the back. He's passionate about encouraging the next generation to share a message of hope.
We do believe that there is hope and life and joy in the Christian message, and to have more people actually intentionally reaching out and seeking it and then finding it and finding comfort in it is incredibly encouraging, and it's a joyous thing.
The Coptic Church has now set up a central role for coordinating responses to inquiries in the UK, confident this trajectory will continue and knowing that the next generation of Coptics here will represent an even greater diversity of backgrounds.
That report from Naomi Wellings. The funeral of Jimmy Cricket was held this week at Salford Cathedral. The Northern Irish comedian became a household name in the 1970s, telling jokes like this from Michael Barrymore's Saturday Night Out in 1989.
And there's more. Ladies and gentlemen, a fella came up to me in the pub. He said, could I tap you for a fiver? I said, for a fiver, you could hit me with a brick. He said, every time I turn my back, I get kicked in the teeth. I said, well, do you want to keep them in a different pocket?
Jimmy Cricket also had a strong Catholic faith, and he received a papal knighthood, recognising his charitable work. Jimmy's son, Father Frankie Mulgrew, led the funeral at Salford Cathedral on Friday. He joins me in the studio. Welcome, Father.
Good morning, William. Thanks for having me on.
What was that like for you? At your father's funeral, to be
officiating.
Well, listen,
it was difficult, but it's something that he wanted. Mm. You know, here's the thing. My dad was such full of faith, it informed everything in his life. It informed his family life, his marriage, his comedy, even death itself. You know, when he got the news a short time back of a very bad prognosis, he didn't have long left to live, he just said to me, son, I'm so unlucky. I bet I'll miss my weight by a couple of days. And then he went, son, if I give you a couple of quid, we have a chat with the bishop, get my funeral in the cathedral. I said, Dad, we will do better than that. We'll get a poster of you. We'll put it up in the window of the cathedral and the window of the funeral home, and we'll put, coming soon. And he just laughed. He just laughed. That's what we did. It's like, and so, you know, what the other day was basically, it was just trying to, like, yeah, to just share about his faith and how important it was to him. And that informed his humour. You know, it's that, William, St. Paul, I reflect on this the other day, St. Paul says a third of the kingdom of heaven is made up of joy. A third of the kingdom of heaven is made up of peace and righteousness, but joy. And so my dad wanted to project that joy out into the world. It says in the Bible 244 times, joy. So, and he just wanted to give people joy.
The humour itself may seem a little dated to some people, because it was so wholesome, so simple, so clean. And the humour of today can be often very, very different. Is that connected to his faith as well?
And it's really interesting, isn't it, that... because people will refer to him as a comedian's comedian.
Yeah.
And we get even young comedians coming up. And insane as well, though, actually his material was contemporary.
Yeah.
He would change it, and it's just a character comedy. And when you went to see my dad live, it just wasn't a comedy performance of jokes. It was comedy dancing, comedy juggling, you know, comedy eccentric dancing impressions. It was this kind of all, you know, my sister said after his passing, do you think Dad is up there now in heaven doing a gig? And I said, maybe. Or maybe he's waiting for Ken Dodd to get off stage. No, but he just, but that, it, Ken would be often asked, who's your favourite comedian? He'd say Jimmy Cricket. Jimmy Cricket. And yeah, that was it. The family sort of humour, he just wanted to bring joy and make people's life just that little
Ken
bit better.
Ken was another papal knight, obviously. Did Jimmy wear the wellies for the official, for the knighthood being conferred? No?
Yeah. Well, he always
said
about his knighthood.
Was he persuaded not to wear the wellies?
He said about the knighthood, well, this will keep my ears warm at night whilst I sleep. You got a papal knight. Yeah, I mean, look, about 20 years ago, my dad sent me off to a priest and he went, don't worry, I'll sacrifice grandchildren. And he got a knighthood from the Pope and a cheap funeral. It really paid off for him. No, he was delighted. You know, it's one of his greatest achievements for papal knight. And he got that for his service to his charities. Because again, that was, he was a man of faith. You know, it's really interesting, William, that just a few hours before he passed, I gave him a thing, Viaticum. We have this thing in Catholic Church, Viaticum, Latin word for food for the journey. It's when you're too ill to come to Mass and we bring Holy Communion out to you. And of course, in the Catholic faith, we believe Holy Communion is the body and blood of Jesus. By now, he's getting weaker and weaker. And even his speech is getting weaker and weaker. And I go out to see him in home. He's in a bed. He wanted to be at home for his final hours, final days. And when I gave him Holy Communion, he just received it. And then he just went, I can feel the presence of God. I can feel the presence of God. I can feel Jesus. I can feel Jesus. And a few hours later, he passed over. But yeah, that was him. He just had this joy. He saw joy in everything. He was almost like a tidal wave of joy, a tour de force of joy. And anybody that came in contact with him would encounter that joy.
What did he say to you when you told him you were going to become a priest?
I sat him down. I sat me and my mum down, okay? And I just signed a contract for Richmond in London to do a pantomime with Patsy Kensey.
You were once Frankie Doodle.
I was once Frankie Doodle, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I sat him down and I've got this pantomime contract and I just said, I really feel the call to priesthood. I've been to see the bishop. Bishop says, you're going to be accepted. Go forward with the priesthood. And so I said, Mum and Dad, I'm going to be a priest. And just deadly silence. My mum got emotional. And then my dad broke the silence and he went, but you're still going to do that pantomime? Because that Christmas pantomime is a really big gig, son. You're still going to do it. He always celebrated. And that was the thing with my vocation is down to my dad. Yes, in comedy, you know, let's say, my dad taught me everything I needed to know about comedy. Mm. That's why I became a Catholic priest. My dad taught me everything I needed to know about women. That's why I became a Catholic priest. No, sorry, I'm just joking. Okay, no, but here's the thing about my dad that, yes, my conversion came through like a confession when I had depression and I really encountered God's personal encounter with God. But also as well, though, when I became a priest, I went into a priesthood because I knew what it was to have a heavenly father that was full of mercy, full of compassion and full of joy because I'd had an earthly version of that.
I want to hear some of your sermons, Frankie. I really do. Finish off for us. Is there a joke that is authentically your dad that has been in your head this week?
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, come here. I rang the local newspaper. I said, local newspaper, come here. I said, how much is it to place an advertisement in the newspaper? They said, it will be £10 an inch. He said, if it's that much, I won't bother. They said, why? What are you trying to sell? A 20-foot ladder. There's more, folks. The resurrection, there is more.
Father Frankie Mulgrew.
Thanks, William.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. It's 7:36 still to come this morning ahead of Ukraine's Independence Day and after Kyiv's worst week of bombardment since the war began. We hear from the Ukrainian Catholic community in Britain about living with fear from afar. Long before sponsorship deals and big money transfers, football grew up alongside the church. Victorian Christian ministers believed sporting talent was God-given. They saw the game as a way of drawing young men away from the pub. Clubs from Everton to Fulham trace their roots to a parish hall, and some of football's fiercest rivalries, Celtic and Rangers amongst them, are rooted in religion. With the new Premier League season kicking off this weekend, let's talk to Dr. Graham Daniels, General Manager of Christians in Sport. Good morning, Graham.
Good morning, William.
I mean, it's a big challenge for you this morning, because I'm looking for a spiritual theology of the beautiful game from you in about 40 seconds.
Oh, straightforward then. There is a creator. He made the ability to run, jump, kick, fall over, and whatever it takes to win. He loves being creative. He made creative creatures. We were fractured, and he wants to help us put it all together again.
I'm going to give you 9 out of 10. You didn't get as far as the ball.
Oh, no. Well, I can't see ball all the time because it's more than football.
But it is true that it is rooted. A lot of these team clubs, I think of Manchester City, for example, rooted in a congregation in Gorton in that case. There's a lot of stories like that.
A lot of stories. Well, in Manchester City's context, Anna Connell was the daughter of the rector, Arthur. And, of course, at that time, it's late Victorian era of unemployment, poverty, drunkenness, violence, sectarian tension, actually.
Yeah.
And so when Gorton was formed, then Ardwick, finally Man City, Anna's vision, and she persuaded her dad to go with it, was to start a football team to try and create some kind of switch on that so that people would find a sense of fulfillment and unity and working together. And of course, churches had facilities. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it, William? They literally had land that you could play on. So people like Anna Connell, were pivotal as Christians to that development.
And some of the context in social and economic terms, Graham, is quite important as well. For example, the Industrial Revolution and the changes in the economy after that and the effect that had on local communities.
Absolutely pivotal. And I think in that sense, one of the bases of everything here was so-called muscular Christianity, coined in 1857. But it was something that went throughout, say, public schools. Thomas Arnold at Rugby School, big on ethics and morality and leadership and sport for that function. But then lots of the clergy, who Oxbridge-type clergy, who were trained from those schools, became the pioneers as ministers of making a difference in a very, very industrial community to try and bring the gospel to bear through sport into the lives of a heavily, heavily oppressed people. So really tremendous continuity, really, theologically, but particularly through that spectrum.
Do you think the contemporary Premier League clubs, for example, who have this kind of spiritual community origin story, do you think they talk about it or do they deliberately not talk about it?
Oh, well, interesting, really. In having to do the research on this a few years ago for some lectures, I actually found that all the clubs at the moment, let's call it 7 of the Premier League clubs for this season, have a church origin. The exception is Liverpool, who fell out with Everton, which was a church club. But let's call it 7. All of them talk about this on their websites, actually, on their media. So they're pretty proud of it, actually.
And then we get some teams today, or at least the management behind some of the teams today, who sometimes talk about a faith-driven approach to running their clubs, don't they? I mean, whatever that means.
Yes, whatever it means in a sense, I suppose. It's about depth as well as breadth, isn't it, William? But Christians in Sport conducted a survey just in time for the World Cup, and a rather remarkable statistic returned. 75% of professional football clubs in England only said that they had Christians, plural, in their first team squads. And 40% of those clubs have a regular weekly meeting, either with a chaplain or peer-led, of Christian people within their club. So it almost has circled around 150 years. But instead of being run, as it were, from the outside by churches who formed this whole thing, or many of them, it's an internal mechanism for people to meet together who do have faith. So it's quite a remarkable period, actually.
What goes around comes around. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Graham. Dr. Graham Daniels, General Manager of Christians in Sport. The Chosen is the most successful crowd-funded drama in broadcast history. It tells the story of Jesus through the eyes of his disciples, followers, and some of his opponents as well. 5 series are now on Amazon Prime Video. A 6th is on the way, alongside a new spin-off called The Chosen in the Wild, where the TV adventurer Bear Grylls gives cast members outdoor challenges.
Naturally, I'm someone who's very afraid.
I throw my neck out very easily. It's made me very hesitant.
Okay. I lost everything. I questioned if I had heard God's calling correctly.
This is not how I pictured life going for me.
Do you think God sometimes doesn't let us see too far ahead? Okay, this is going to be our way down.
Really? I'm no professional, but this looks like a parachute. It's a parachute.
I've been talking to Bear Grylls about his new series.
It really took me by surprise, this one. I mean, first of all, you know, it's always kind of fun to be part of something culturally that's such a phenomenon, you know, and I've been a fan of that show. I know the impact it's had on millions of people around the world. I mean, hundreds of millions of people around the world. Mm. And when they came to me and they said, what about like taking some of these, the stars of that show out into the wild and getting to hear their stories, it was really compelling, you know. And I think unlike the normal show I do of Running Wild, you know, I think what I wasn't prepared for with this is how much playing these characters of The Chosen has impacted and changed the lives of the actual actors. That one really surprised me. And, you know, they were so transformative, these, you know, these actors' stories of actually what they went through. And I like the fact that they were all chosen from, you know, they weren't chosen because they were people of faith necessarily. They all came from many different faiths and backgrounds. But there was something very powerful that touched all of them. And, you know, when you spend time in the outdoors with people, you have time and space to hear these sort of stories, and there was a lot of emotion. And I don't know, this show has touched a lot of people, and I kind of just wasn't really ready in a way for that, and it's been a great privilege.
That is really intriguing, actually, because you would have thought actors walk in the footsteps of their characters all the time. Why these particular characters, and what's the dynamic there? How have these biblical characters affected or changed the lives of the actors of the cast?
Yeah, and I think especially with the Jonathan Rumi episode, you know, the actor that plays Jesus, you know, it's going to mess with you. It's going to be hard. It's going to be a challenging thing for your head and for your heart. And he was such a sort of gentle, humble, great guy, and hearing his journey and the struggles that naturally are going to come along with playing a role of that intensity. I don't know, that one was special for me. I've one of my dreams, my family, my kids said to me once, they said, Papa, you've taken Obama into the wild and Prime Minister Modi. Just imagine if one day you could take Jesus. and finally that dream kind of semi came true. Although I suppose you could argue the real Jesus never really leaves our sides. So, but this, it was really fun. You know, I did have to resist the dad jokes when I took Jonathan away.
Oh, like, sure.
Telling him that fishing's going to be easy this evening, you know, with, or I'll kayak across this lake and you can walk. Once we got into it, he was, like I say, he was such a genuine, wonderful guy. And it's been a privilege to do.
There is something odd about walking, even in the open air, walking by a beach, walking on a hill or on a mountain. It does something to your mental space, doesn't it? In a way that sort of sitting in a counselling room or sitting in an office doesn't.
Mm. Yeah, it's so interesting. It really is. And it's like, I don't know, I always remember that my grandpa having a little thing beside his bed that just said, there's always music in the garden.
Yeah.
But sometimes our hearts need to be quiet to hear it. For me, the outdoors is like that. And, you know, we all live busy lives. And I think kind of tech has made everything even busier. And, you know, you're permanently assaulted by stuff. And I don't know, even if it's just being outside in the morning with the dogs and taking a walk, you know, space, isn't it, to breathe and to have fresh air and sun on your face. And I value it more and more. And I see the power of how, in terms of kind of like the TV shows I do, how it opens people up. It's different to a chat show. It's not like a 3-minute performance on a sofa where you're telling a funny story. You know, you climb a cliff and cross a river and sit around a campfire. You kind of get to know the real person, and there's space and time for people to share honest, vulnerable struggles in their journey as well as the highlights. And I think that's been the magic to this show, especially The Chosen and The Wild One, just giving people space to talk about the things like faith, because faith is such a big part of so many people's journey. Even if people who don't necessarily go to church or wouldn't call themselves religious. I very rarely meet people who don't have any spiritual element to their life. You can get covered over a little and a little dusty sometimes with all of us, but it's part of who we are as humans. And I think the outdoors gives us space and time to talk about that and share that together. And that's been special.
Bear Grylls on his new series, The Chosen in the Wild. Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, has faced its most intense Russian aerial attacks since the war began, with 17 people killed when an apartment block was bombed on Thursday, drone strikes on a shopping centre on Friday, killing another 16 people, injuring another 130. It comes after President Putin warned Britain of consequences following confirmation that British drones were used in recent Ukrainian strikes on Russia. Kyiv's mayor says close to 4,000 buildings in the city have now been damaged since the invasion began in 2022. As Ukraine prepares to mark 35 years of independence tomorrow, on Monday, I've been speaking to Bishop Kenneth Nowakowski of the Ukrainian Catholic Church in London, who joined us from Kyiv.
Since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022, we have welcomed to the United Kingdom almost 300,000 people. Now, not all of those 300,000 people are necessarily churchgoers or Ukrainian Greek Catholics, but a large number are. And we have found that we were able to welcome them, provide them a place of spiritual home and a place of comfort over these last 5 years. Being something that is familiar to people that have come in trauma, I think, has been very significant. And the church in the diaspora, although certainly feels to be British, but we retain our cultural and religious and spiritual connections with our homeland.
What has it been like for you and for your congregation in the past week? It's been a particularly deadly week for many people, obviously, in Kyiv, as you watch from afar.
Well, certainly everybody is listening and watching the media and being able to phone their loved ones that are living in Ukraine, hoping and praying that their hometowns, their villages are not affected by the bombing. And certainly we try to give people a sense of hope and resilience that things will be okay. We're not sure when that's going to be okay, but we certainly are very grateful to the British public, to the government, and indeed to the royal family for all of the support they've shown to Ukrainians, both in the United Kingdom and in Ukraine. It's a terrible time for people, not knowing what the future can be. But we are hopeful, we pray that the right to freedom and independence and peace will prevail.
I'm sure not everyone who comes to your masses, Bishop, is especially religious. I assume that some come because of a sense of identity, a sense of community, seeking friendship and fellowship and companionship within your community as well.
Well, I hope that all of our parishes in the United Kingdom are a place that people can find welcome, regardless of their backgrounds, that it's a spiritual home that they can come to feel part of a community and that is welcoming. And even if they're not Ukrainian, even if they're British and want to somehow be spiritually supportive and show their solidarity with Ukrainians, that they would join us at our services. Now, of course, most of our services are conducted in Ukrainian, but I hope that our communities continue to be open and welcoming to all people.
What about other Christian denominations, brother and sister churches in the UK? Have you experienced solidarity?
Since the first days of the full-scale invasion, I have to say that the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales, and indeed the Church of England and churches together in London, have been so supportive. We've received so many acts of charity and kindness over the last 5 years. Any time that we've had interfaith and ecumenical prayer services, we felt the support and care and love of our brothers and sisters from other Christian denominations, but also other faith groups as well. And we're extremely grateful for that and for their care and compassion. And it's shown often when we've needed a place to hold our religious services. The churches have, of various denominations, have opened up their premises for us to use, sometimes only temporarily for a short period of time, but others in the last while being long-term. And certainly they have participated in charitable activities that have assisted us, whether it's been donating money for the purchase of ambulances or vans or trucks to send to Ukraine to help on the front lines. It's been overwhelmingly a positive experience.
Bishop Kenneth Nowakowski, who leads the Ukrainian Catholic community in the UK, joining us from Kyiv there ahead of Ukrainian Independence Day, which is tomorrow. That is your lot for this week's Sunday. You can, of course, get in touch with us by email to sunday@bbc.co.uk. Follow us on social media at BBCR4Sunday. Download the programme, listen again as a podcast from BBC Science. Emily Buchanan will be here next week. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Sunday was produced by Katie Booth and James Leasley. Now the actor Peter Egan, patron for International Animal Rescue, makes the Radio 4 appeal on behalf of the charity.
Her body was frail, and her eyes told a story of a spirit crushed. This was the moment, in 2024, when I met Retta on a rescue mission to Armenia with International Animal Rescue. Retta is a Syrian brown bear. They are intelligent creatures, curious, born for vast landscapes and open skies. Yet despite being a protected species, Retta had spent years confined to a dirty cage, fed on scraps of food at a tourist resort. Our team had been alerted to the terrible condition she was living in, and seeing her, I felt a mixture of heartbreak and hope. Heartbreak for all that she had endured, and hope as she was set free. International Animal Rescue saves animals around the world, from sloth bears in India, orangutans in Indonesia, to howler monkeys in Costa Rica. Retta was taken to our sanctuary in Ercador, where we currently look after 28 bears. As is so often the case, Retta showed us the weight of her past. Years of chronic stress had rewired her brain, disrupting her ability to feel calm and safe. So her mind created ways to cope, pacing in endless circles, swaying back and forth, retreating, terrified at the sound of human voices. It took time, but today, Retta's days are much brighter. She's living happily at the sanctuary with fellow bears Dilly, Clivey, and Ando. Her confidence and endearing personality has begun to shine through as she splashes in her pool and climbs the wobble tree filled with food. We estimate around 20 more Syrian bears like Retta are currently being kept in captivity in Armenia, sometimes in private residences as pets or more public venues for entertainment. That's why I'm asking for your help today. It costs around £5,000 to rescue a bear. This covers transport, veterinary care, and sanctuary staff. And to increase the impact of your donation, a charitable trust which supports International Animal Rescue will match every pound you give up to a total of £30,000. To donate, just search online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal or call 0800 404 8144. Or you can write a cheque to International Animal Rescue and send it to Free Post, BBC Radio 4 Appeal. That's the whole address, and importantly, please mark the back of your envelope, International Animal Rescue. Thank you.
Peter Egan. The number to call again, 0800 404 8144. The calls are free from landlines and also from mobiles. And you can find all the details for giving online if you search for BBC Radio 4 Appeal. Remember, if you are a UK taxpayer and if you want International Animal Rescue to collect the gift aid on your donation, please include an email or postal address so they can send you a gift aid declaration. Time now for a weather update. Here's Sarah Keith-Lucas.
Thank you, Neil. Well, we've got another fine, dry day ahead today. It's been quite a fresh start to the day. In fact, temperatures across parts of England and Wales have been down at just 2 degrees. But the strong August sunshine is getting going now, and that'll make things feel increasingly warm later on. For Northern Ireland and Scotland, there's going to be more cloud around, particularly in the north, anywhere north of the central belt in Scotland and close to the north coast of Northern Ireland. Here we've got the cloud thick enough for a few drizzly showers on and off, but they are hit and miss, whereas further south across the region, it should stay dry with some sunshine. For England and Wales, here we've got longer spells of blue sky and sunshine, although fair weather cloud will tend to bubble up as we move through the day, and there could be just a passing isolated shower close to the southeast coast today. Top temperatures, if you've got the cloud across Scotland and Northern Ireland, typically about 16 or 17 degrees. Could see 19 or 20 though here where the sun does come out. And across England and Wales, widely we're looking at temperatures around 21 to 24 or perhaps 25 Celsius. So we end the day on that dry, fine note with light winds, some late sunshine, stays dry through the night, and cloud in the north will drift its way away towards the north. So clearer skies for Scotland and Northern Ireland compared to last night. It'll be a little bit fresher to start the day tomorrow. So tomorrow, high pressure still with us. Another dry day with some sunshine, but quite a brisk easterly breeze will develop in the south tomorrow. That'll take the edge off the temperatures. The dry weather continues for most of us into Tuesday, although some showers will start to move in from the south. Then things turn more widely unsettled with showers and thunderstorms from Wednesday to Friday.
Many thanks, Sarah Keith-Lucas with the weather. Let's look ahead now to Broadcasting House coming up in an hour from now. Good morning, Paddy O'Connell.
Neil Nunes, good morning to you and hello to you. Well, two news reports on the programme in 1 hour. Mayors across England will be given new planning powers to overrule local councils. And shipbuildings returning to the yard which built the Titanic. We report live on both of those. We speak to the mayor of Como in Italy, who's banned cyclists from key streets after he was knocked to the floor by an e-bike. We ask Radio 4 listeners, that includes you, what is the solution to this growing problem? Peter Hitchens says, treat e-bikes like motorbikes and the problem will end. And arriving shortly, our guests thumbing through the news, Wilfred Emmanuel Jones, Callum Leslie and Naomi Alderman, all waiting for you in an hour.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday the 23rd of August. Good morning, this is Charles Carroll. Regional mayors in England are to get a greater say about whether to approve major housing and business developments. Prisoners released on licence could see their movements restricted to areas of just a few miles. And a small power plant was shut down after reportedly being hacked by targeted by hackers linked to Iran. The Prime Minister is to give regional mayors across England greater powers over planning decisions. The change would mean they could overrule local councils and, for some large-scale projects, grant upfront planning permission to developers. The Conservatives say the government is stripping local authorities of their ability to make planning decisions. Our political correspondent, Shelley Phelps, reports.
The plans would give all elected mayors in England the same powers over planning the Mayor of London currently has. Decisions over projects deemed important for local growth, such as large housing or commercial developments, could be taken out of the hands of local councils and be made by regional mayors. They would also be able to charge a levy on successful planning applications in order to fund major infrastructure projects, as was used to help pay for the new Elizabeth line in the capital. But even with his enhanced powers, Sadiq Khan has missed London's reduced targets for affordable housing. The Housing Minister, Matthew Pennycook, said despite that, they were important tools that had worked and would allow mayors to set the strategic direction of their area.
Serious sexual and violent offenders could be confined to areas of just a few miles after being released from prison on licence. The government hopes the restrictions will give victims the freedom to go about their daily lives without fear. The scheme will be introduced in England and Wales later this year. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
The intention to introduce restriction zones for violent offenders who leave prison and who are on probation was first announced by the government last year. The new Justice Secretary, Alex Norris, says these will now be introduced in October. Probation officers will be able to limit where serious offenders can go for as long as it's deemed necessary. Those who breach the new boundaries could be recalled to prison. This would go beyond the current practice of imposing exclusion zones, which ban offenders from specific locations, such as a victim's home or place of work. Mr. Norris is expected to come up with proposals to further restrict the early release of some prisoners when Parliament resumes next month. But the Conservatives say the best thing Labour could do to protect victims is to bring forward emergency legislation which would stop the early release of thousands of criminals.
A small power plant has been shut down during a cyber attack. The Sunday Telegraph said it was carried out last month by hackers affiliated to the Iranian regime. The government said that there was no risk at any point to the UK's energy system. Here's Tom Symonds.
For security reasons, neither the government nor the National Cyber Security Centre, which deals with attacks on critical infrastructure, would give further details of the site affected. However, this was not an attack on an essential service, such as a large power station. The Department for Energy Security and Net Zero said the incident affected a small-scale generator, and at no point was there a risk to the wider energy system. The UK's power network has a number of smaller gas generators which provide short-term power when needed. Protecting the country's supplies is a key challenge for the government. It's updating its regulations for cybersecurity and working on a new energy resilience strategy for later this year.
President Trump has hit out at Canada for walking away from a trade deal, triggering US tariffs on a range of items from hockey sticks to cement. Mr. Trump accused Canada of charging American farmers what he called massive amounts of tariffs for years. The Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney said the US trade offer on the table had been a bad deal. Part of the A66 remains closed this morning after a crash that killed seven people, including two Cleveland police officers. Our reporter Philippa Goymer is at the scene.
A police cordon remains in place on a stretch of the A66 between Middlesbrough and Redcar after yesterday's early morning crash. A response vehicle being used by police constables Matthew Blades and Tom Clough was hit by a Volkswagen Passat travelling in the wrong direction. The road closure will be in place for several more hours while investigations by the Independent Office for Police Conduct continue. The identities of those travelling in the Passat has not been confirmed, but the BBC understands they were all young men in their late teens and early 20s from the local area. The IOPC is expected to confirm their names later today.
Ukraine's former defence minister has used an interview with BBC News to reiterate his call for the country to hold wartime elections. In a video last week, Mikhailo Fedorov said democracy could not be held hostage by Russia. A source in President Zelensky's office said that a call for elections demonstrated a complete lack of realism. Mr. Fedorov, who was sacked last month, was asked whether he really believed sending people to the polls was in the interests of Ukraine and not his own.
It's definitely in my vested interest because I want this war to be over and Ukraine to become a successful country. So yeah, this is in my interest for sure. But of course, it's also in the interest of all Ukrainians. But if you're asking whether it will be useful for my political future, if I were thinking about this, I would not have made this statement.
Records set by real athletes were broken on the opening day of the World Humanoid Robot Games in Beijing. One of the robots beat Usain Bolt's 100-meter sprint time. The competition continues today with firefighting, table tennis and Tai Chi events. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker reports.
Hundreds of humanoid robots marched and danced in formation while waving to thousands of cheering crowds as the five-day event got underway yesterday. There were gasps in the crowd as a humanoid robot reached 2.88 metres in a standing high jump, beating the human record and the benchmark set in the first games last year of 0.95 metres. A machine also beat the human 100-metre sprint record. China makes more humanoid robots than any other country in the world. And even before this sporting spectacle, its technological advances had been noticed in Washington. The US has banned imports of new foreign-made humanoid robots, citing national security concerns.
A piano and a microphone used by Freddie Mercury, along with early drafts of his songwriting, are expected to fetch hundreds of thousands of pounds at auction in October. The Yamaha C3 grand piano was played extensively by the Queen frontman while composing some of the band's biggest hits, including Crazy Little Thing Called Love. Well, that's the news. Now we'll look at the Sunday papers. The Sunday Times says that Russia has withdrawn its ambassador to the UK without naming anyone to replace him, prompting fears that there may be a downgrade of diplomatic relations between the two countries. The paper suggests the removal of Andrei Kelin, who'd been ambassador for 7 years, is part of a bid to force Britain to reconsider its support for Ukraine. Will she, won't she, asks the Sunday Telegraph, as the paper reports that the Duchess of Sussex's return to acting has been thrown into uncertainty. The Sun on Sunday claims a £1 million deal to appear in The Gentlemen is off. The paper is among a number to quote the writer Tina Brown, who claims the casting offer has been withdrawn because of an intense backlash against Meghan Markle in the UK. The Duchess of Sussex has been approached for comment. The Mail on Sunday says that a poll of 2,000 people shows that just 4% of Britons believe the Prince of Wales should be the one to make the first move in peace talks with his brother, the Duke of Sussex. 27% of people think that they should make amends equally together. In its editorial, the Mail says it's vital the brothers do reconcile for the sake of the monarchy and their sick father. The Sunday Telegraph has more details on what it calls the unprecedented cyber attack on a British power plant. The paper understands it was carried out by Iranian-backed hackers at the same time as a series of attacks on wastewater plants which affected 12 states in the US. The UK attack is thought to be the first time that hackers affiliated with Tehran have succeeded in closing down such a facility in Britain. The government said the UK had a highly resilient energy sector. According to the Sunday Times, 10 of England's mayors have already backed Andy Burnham's plans to give them more powers to overrule councils on house building projects. The Prime Minister tells the paper the policy will enable mayors to overcome what he calls NIMBY councils, which refuse permission for much needed new homes. But the Sunday Times leader asks, how will Burnham manage the backlash from communities adamantly opposed to certain initiatives? And many of the back pages have some fun highlighting Manchester United's bad start to the new Premier League season, losing their opening game 2-0 to Hull. Humbled on Humberside, declares the Sunday Express. The Mail on Sunday says United took one Hull of a beating, while the Sun on Sunday suggests Michael Carrick's team went to Hull and back. A look at Sunday's papers.
Many thanks, Charles Carroll. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 8:10. And time now for Sunday worship, which today comes from Edinburgh.
Good morning and welcome to Sunday worship from the Edinburgh Festival. My name is Philip Blackledge and I'm a priest in the Scottish Episcopal Church. And as you can hear, Edinburgh gets quite busy at this time of year. I'm on the Royal Mile and I love the buzz of this city. I came to Edinburgh as a university student almost 35 years ago, and I came during the festival to sing in St Mary's Episcopal Cathedral. And as I walk these streets now, it feels just like it did back then. Full of all ethnicities and nationalities, folk in fancy dress trying to press flyers into your hand, the laughter of crowds as they see the street performers, the echo of music from bands and choirs. When I got to the cathedral as a rather naive country boy, the cathedral services themselves felt a bit like a grand theatre production. To me, they are all bound up in the common memory of the festival. And although, then as now, the offerings of the festival are incredibly varied, they feel bound up in a common aim, where ordinary people become something extraordinary, and where people take on roles and personas where they become someone different, and in doing that they find themselves in touch with something deep about human nature. And the joy of the festival is that it's communal. We do that together. And it's a great gathering of voices that united in Reed Memorial Church Edinburgh to sing for Sunday worship this morning.
members of the Edinburgh Festival Chorus. Psalm 100 says, "Worship the Lord with gladness, come before him with joyful songs." It's something we are all invited to do. Members of the Edinburgh Festival Chorus, conducted by James Grossmith, and they'll be singing for us throughout the service, accompanied by Imogen Morgan and Stuart Hope. I've now come out of the crowds into the cool and peaceful haven of Old St Paul's Church near Waverley Station, and I'm joined today by Fiona Stewart, a broadcaster and podcaster who has been involved in the Christian arts in Scotland for many years. Fiona, Christianity has a sort of theatrical creativity to it. It's kind of in the DNA, isn't it?
Yeah, it can do. And I think different expressions of Christianity, probably some are more inclined towards the theatrical and the story, and others are maybe more didactic. But, you know, my understanding of God is ultimately the most exuberant creator that there is. And so any expression of that is an expression of who we are as human beings made in his image, you know, bringers of joy and builders of beautiful things for the world. And, you know, like the proverbial beggar who's found bread. I want to share what I've discovered and help provoke people's curiosity after God. A really good piece of art will do that. It'll connect us with the divine, with the sense of the spiritual, the sense that there's more to life than just the here and now and the physical. We are made to be storytellers, I think, to be creators. And so you can kind of suppress that with theology. But at the end of the day, I think that, you know, your basic humanity is going to always lend itself towards expression.
When we're performing, we become a slightly different version of ourselves in order to get those things across. What do you feel is happening for you when that happens?
Oh, it's a very interesting question. There is a facet of me in it. Of course there is. There's a lot that I observe in other people, and that becomes a form of mimicry of somebody else. But there's also something about reaching into the deep places and pulling that out almost onto the mask that I wear, in order that people can look at that mask and see something of the fears and the doubts and the absurdity of their own experience played out in front of them.
Yeah, and I think you find that richness and depth of every human character. And in a way, that's what the festival is celebrating today.
Yeah, absolutely. We should go and watch the show now.
Well, before we do that, could you lead us in prayer?
I'd love to. God of feasts and abundance, as we find the divine in earthly things, give us the grace to seek you wherever you may be found. We thank you for the gift of imagination, which enables us to see the world from a perspective different from our own. May art and music help us find you in new and unexpected places, that we may see you anew in ourselves
and in the faces of friends and strangers. Amen.
One of the most striking things about the Festival of the Arts is that art is literally artifice. It's something constructed. We find our truths through becoming other people. One of the great traditions in the arts is that of the storyteller. In the parable of the prodigal son, Jesus tells us a vivid story about a young man who thinks of himself as one thing and becomes another, and then finds his true self, not in his own self-understanding, but in the robes his father puts upon him.
Jesus said, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his field to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am, starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let us have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'"
Thank you.
The parable of the prodigal son is a rich one. And one thing that really comes through to me about that story is when the father puts robes and a ring on his son. It's strikingly familiar to what we do in church. Now joining me is John McCluckie, who is a colleague of mine in the Edinburgh Diocese. His church here at Old St Paul's is a venue for many fringe concerts, and the Anglo-Catholic style of worship here involves quite a lot of dressing up.
It does indeed.
So John, when you come through the doors of this place, it feels a bit to me like an early church cave.
Mm. It's quite an anonymous front on the street. So when people come in and they see beautiful gilded altar pieces and icons and really impressive liturgical spaces, they are, I think, surprised that there's a place of stillness and silence. It's wonderful.
What do you think all that dressing up and ritual and theatrical liturgy does for us?
I think one of the differences between a performance and conducting liturgy is that we're not hiding our personalities, we're not obliterating them by putting on these ritual clothes and by enacting these quite formal ritual gestures. But we are, as it were, getting ourselves out of the way, as little of a distraction as possible for the people who are worshipping so that they can participate as fully as possible.
Sometimes it feels at this time of year as though Edinburgh is itself putting on some robes and a persona which is not necessarily the one that we see during the year.
We're very conscious that the space in our church hall, which is currently used as a theatre space, is also the space where we feed hungry and vulnerable people 3 times a week, but that those two worlds often just don't connect very much at all. So during the lunches that we serve on a Monday, from the very start we wanted that to be something that was shared and not dispensing charity towards others but sharing food together. And so to have got to know people over the last few years of doing this just by sitting and eating with them is hugely touching. Spending time with people who you wouldn't otherwise necessarily have much of a chance to talk to has been really rewarding.
Well, we're now out in the Queen's Park beside Arthur's Seat, this huge hill right in the middle of our city. And my goodness, it's beautiful. And in the middle of the sunshine in Edinburgh, here comes a lot of rain. You know you're in Scotland when you experience all 4 seasons in the same day. It's not just in art and worship that we create roles and personas for ourselves. It happens in life too.
We sometimes literally wear costumes. We might have a job which requires a certain uniform, whether that's a police uniform or a high-vis jacket or a business suit or a dog collar. But we're not likely to wear the same clothes when we're in the pub with our friends. We can sometimes become different versions of ourselves in different situations, and that's normal and probably healthy. But sometimes the images that other people have of us feel like a barrier to communicating our true selves rather than a means of truth. Sarah Adedeji was brought up a Christian, and her show Pray For Me explores what it was like growing up as a deaf black woman in a context where many people felt she was somebody to be fixed or healed, rather than a beloved child of God exactly as she was. Earlier, I went to speak with Sarah at a festival venue.
I've not really been involved in many conversations about deafness and religion, and it's not been brought into the art industry. And to bring it onto a stage, going to three different cities, it's been quite exhilarating. Finally getting that story out there and kind of empowering other people to talk about these things as well. I had eventually left the church because of these issues. My whole faith and everything kind of broke down. So having people come back and seeing me come out of that on the other side as a better version of myself, who is a lot more comfortable to educate those in the Christian spaces. So I'm kind of doing this for me, but for other people who may not feel ready. There's been experiences, which I also explore in the show, where someone has, you know, put their fingers in my ears to heal me. I've been in a church where they would play kind of like campaign videos of the bishop healing deaf people, and then people around me are just kind of like looking at me like, if this person is able to be healed, why aren't you yet healed? And it kind of made me question my faith, and it made me feel incomplete, like maybe God doesn't love me. So it was quite traumatic growing up in the church and being surrounded by people who thought I wasn't complete. But thankfully, there were still people within that. One or two people actually said to me, how do we know it's not God's purpose for you to be deaf? How do we know you weren't put on this earth to kind of change things within the Christian space? Who are we to say that you're supposed to be hearing? So with those people in my corner, it made it easier again to kind of be more assertive in myself and say, actually, I need to kind of step away from these narratives and these ideas people are putting on to me, and actually have that conversation with God myself and be like, if you actually wanted me to be hearing, I feel like you would have done it by now. So surely there's a purpose here, and I'm waiting for you to kind of like say that to me. So I guess working towards accepting my deafness and my identity within that had helped me to shape a better understanding of what it's like to be a Christian and how it is to be in a church as well.
Yeah. My mother was disabled all of her life, and often people would talk to me because I was pushing her wheelchair, and sometimes they would call her a wheelchair rather than a person.
I guess when it comes to speaking to people who are not educated or aware, we didn't want to call them ignorant. It's just a new concept for them. It's just merely society not understanding.
As a priest, it kind of breaks my heart that you had to leave the church. What's your relationship with God now?
It is still quite nuanced. I'm someone that still craves to be able to be with my people, to fellowship. I'm still struggling to understand how God could be talking to me, but I'm not ready to abandon it, and I don't want to ever abandon it. I'm working on it.
Yeah. The prophets in the Bible saw things from a different perspective. They knew they had a grace inside that they had to share. And it feels to me that you've been a prophet in that way.
I don't want to cry. I'll be okay. Thank you.
The world can impose roles on us all. We can lose a sense of who we are. I used to do that a lot. It is easy to be a people pleaser, and I had a desire to be, to quote St. Paul, all things to all people, in order to try and stop people being angry at me or disappointed with me. But it resulted in me wearing so many masks, I wasn't even sure who the real me was anymore. Until one day I sat in the Church of Old St. Paul's and spoke to God in the silence. I said, "There's only you and me here, God, and I don't know who either of those people is." I think it was perhaps my first honest prayer. And I stayed in the silence of that place, and slowly I began to feel that even though I didn't know who I was, and even though I didn't know who God was, he knew me. The parable of the prodigal son is one which has accompanied me through my journey of faith and in and out of doubt too. Sometimes I feel I'm the prodigal, sometimes I feel as though I'm the rather jealous, dutiful other son, and in later life I sometimes feel that I'm the father. It is a vast, compelling story. The plot is the stuff of grand opera. Being a dad terrified me when I became one. What sort of father should I be? I tried them all out. Patient, wise, stern, indulgent. Being a parent isn't easy, and it certainly wasn't for the dad in this story. The son remembers his dad as wise, kind, but still of that traditional father mould. That's who he thinks the father is. And he's so wrong. Imagine being that dad, knowing nothing about your son, perhaps other than some troubling rumours. Imagine when the famine came, wondering whether you would ever see your son again. Imagine walking down that lane, yearning for a glimpse of the son who has abandoned you. And then he sees a figure coming towards him, a figure in rags, covered in filth and pig dirt, barefoot and as unclean as anyone can be. That's what everyone else would have seen. If they knew the son, perhaps they would have seen a broken, arrogant brat coming home with his tail between his legs. But that father doesn't see the dirt and the pig filth. He doesn't see the ragged clothes and the lost property and the squandered wealth and the wasted life. He sees his son. And that father does something a dignified, respectable man in his culture would never do. He runs. He runs to his son, towards this pile of stench and mess, and embraces him, becomes unclean, takes on his uncleanness. Everything about his status in the world has been overridden because he has seen his son, and his one desire is to hold him, and he kisses his soiled face. And before his son can come out with his silly prepared speech, the father says quick and puts sandals on his feet and dresses him in the best robes he has and puts a ring on his finger, a symbol of belonging to the family. And there the son stands, gloriously arrayed, still stinking, with dirty hands and face. Not restored, but redeemed. He is different now.
For the rest of his life, that prodigal son will have about him what Pope Francis described as an embarrassed dignity. An embarrassed dignity. And that is us. Here, the one who knows us better than anyone else puts a robe upon us which we know we do not deserve, and yet we know that this persona, the beloved of the Father, is the one which will enable us to uncover the truth about ourselves and about God. It would not be right to say that we're not good enough, because that would be rejecting the Father all over again. It is not right to pretend that we are not filthy with our own mistakes, because that is denying who we are. We need to live with that embarrassed dignity, because anything less diminishes the Father and denies part of our true selves. These are the robes we are called to wear. This is the theatre we are called to play. Sometimes we put on masks, our robes, and we become diminished, but sometimes we are given our roles, and through them we become the fullness of what we can be. And when the Father gives us fine clothing and tells us that we are worthy, even when we feel we know that we are not, out of love of him, we might just begin to believe it.
Thank you.
God of the prodigal and of the faithful, give us the grace to know you are with us, that your love for us never changes, and even if we do not know ourselves, you know us, are with us, and hear us.
We pray for openness of hearts and minds, that we can learn from one another, share and trust one another, in the knowledge that in finding each other, we draw closer to you.
We pray for those who feel weighed down by their past mistakes and yearn for new beginnings. We pray for the parents who yearn for their children and children who feel the ache of loss. Gracious God, come and renew us. Give us the knowledge that all can be made new.
We pray for those who do not feel seen or understood, those who are judged or disregarded because of the colour of their skin, their culture or creed, their gender or sexuality, or any of the other many ways we find to divide ourselves from one another. May we feel the Father's yearning for his Son as we gaze upon all of your children. Amen.
May God the Father run towards us in joyful love. May God the Son welcome us with open arms. May God the Holy Spirit bring us back to ourselves when we are far off. And the blessing of God Almighty, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit be with us now and forevermore. Amen.
Sunday worship was presented by Father Philip Blackledge. Members of the Edinburgh Festival Chorus were directed by James Gross-Smith and accompanied by Imogen Morgan and Stuart Hope. The producer was Mo McCulloch. At the same time next week here on BBC Radio 4, Sunday worship comes from the ancient monastic site of Nendrum, County Down, in the first of a series of programmes exploring the holy coastlines of the United Kingdom. Now let's look ahead to this evening here on Radio 4.
The ringing room is going to get very hot and sweaty and probably very humid. Those are not nice conditions for ringing a 3-ton ring of bells.
It's competition time for the bell ringers of St Martin's in the Bullring.
It's difficult, it's complex.
At this year's National 12 Bell Striking Contest.
Birmingham has 26 wins. In second place, the college youths have won 5 times.
But will they regain their title?
I think we're satisfied.
No mistakes, and it all felt pretty good.
Ringing the Bullring on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, tonight at 7:15.
Artists and organisers of the biggest pop festival of the 20th century, the Isle of Wight Festival, are reunited in the new series of The Reunion, which starts later this morning at 10 o'clock. Now, we're going back to 1993, when the novel Paddy Clark Ha 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 won the Booker Prize for Fiction. It was remarkable for the way it conveyed a gritty drama through the eyes of a 10-year-old boy. Witness History's Ben Henderson has been to Dublin to meet its author, Roddy Doyle.
I found out later it was huge excitement here as it was happening, because when you live in a small country, these things become quite significant.
Like his fictional character, Paddy Clark, Roddy grew up on the outskirts of Dublin in the 1960s. It was a time of rapid change, with country fields replaced by housing estates. Roddy and his friends would play in the building sites, and, as in the novel, it wasn't always gentle.
The level of threat in the world of the boys came from, well, my childhood. The schoolyard could be a vicious place, and you could be well in with the gang leader at one point, but then ostracised for something that you missed. You didn't know what happened. You had to bring something into the gang. And luckily, and I knew it, I had a sense of humour. If you were sitting beside me, it may not have been the coolest thing ever, but you get the odd laugh.
When he wasn't cracking jokes, young Roddy developed a passion for reading.
My father used to bring me to the library, and he'd park me in the children's section and he'd go off looking for books for himself. And I remember picking up Just William, the Richmond Crompton novel, and brought it home and loved it, absolutely loved it. It didn't feel like the adventures of an English boy, it just felt like the adventures of a boy. And all the adults were idiots, and that seemed to tally with my take on the world at that stage. It really hasn't altered much.
After graduating from university, Roddy became a teacher, using the school holidays to try his hand at writing. He self-published his debut novel, The Commitments, in 1987, which became a cult success. Then, over the next few years, he wrote 2 more novels, plays and screenplays, including a film adaptation of The Commitments, which was a massive global hit. On top of that, he became a father in 1991, and through all of this, he was still a full-time teacher.
It was very, very busy. I'd write at lunchtime in the school if I got a bit of time. I remember having a jumper hanging at the front door so I'd have at least one garment to put on that wasn't covered in baby puke. You know, walking in the night, you know, trying to get the baby to go back to sleep. Getting up the following morning, maybe I had a time to write a little bit before going off to work again.
Becoming a father made Roddy cast his mind back to his childhood, and he began work on Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha.
The capturing of the 10-year-old was in a way enhanced or made easier by the conditions I was living in, because I was grabbing moments to write. And I was visiting the house I grew up in, bringing the baby to visit his grandparents. And I remember once going into the kitchen, which was the same kitchen I had grown up in. And I got down on my knees beside the fridge to see what it might have been like when I was a 10-year-old boy, what the door was like relative to my size.
The story is told in the first person through Paddy's eyes, but rather than a chronological narrative divided neatly into chapters, it unfolds in a series of often unconnected anecdotes. Paddy often leaves conversations unexplained, especially those involving adults. and information that might seem important to us, names, dates and locations, is often left out. We only discover the action takes place in the late 1960s from cultural references, such as the Manchester United footballers he loves. The overall effect is to create a vivid sense of what it's like to be a 10-year-old boy.
Like in the same way that children don't differentiate between what's important and what's unimportant, they're all, everything is fascinating. That's the way to go. I didn't have to worry too much about the structure at the time.
Through Paddy's observations, the reader's job is to piece together the narrative, hidden in the subtext. The sound of a smack, his father going for a late night walk, his mother not appearing for breakfast.
The first draft was a total mess. I printed it all out and I gathered up pages that broadly were heading him in a direction. And I began to see that the story was a spiral. At first it all seems a bit random, but gradually this awareness that Paddy realises that all is not well at home takes command of the story, and it becomes more of a straight line, and the writing becomes a bit sparer, and that charming, I suppose, facet of the writing that this 10-year-old boy's take on the world begins to be smothered by something a bit more urgent and sad.
As Paddy's parents' marriage disintegrates, he takes on his father's responsibilities at home while facing social ostracism at school.
I remember sitting in the office, rearranging the pages on the floor, and I had my ending. I remember thinking his father on the doorstep coming to visit was the perfect way to stop. And I hadn't sat down to write that morning knowing this was going to be the end. And a slight panic, because I'd suddenly realised it's the end. And there was no glee, or there was no, oh, I must go off and have a drink, or, you know, anything like that. There was a kind of panic. I remember feeling that.
And how did you come up with the title?
I contacted my publisher and editor, Dan Franklin, told him I had a new book. He said, great, we'll bring it out next year, May. We've also called, I didn't have a title. I'm not very good at titles, but in this case, I was going through the manuscript, so to speak, and I saw that the cruel chant of Paddy's friends in the schoolyard, Paddy Clark, ha, ha, has no da, ha, ha. And I just thought, Paddy Clark, ha, ha.
The novel was published in 1993 to critical acclaim.
I remember being told that it had gone to number one in the British bestsellers list and being really taken aback and delighted at that.
Later that year, it was shortlisted for the Booker Prize for novels written in English. Music.
Roddy Doyle's Paddy Clark Ha 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 for the creation of Paddy Clark himself, and David Malouf's Remembering Babylon.
The camera was roving, and the way we were positioned seemed to be some sort of a rough circle. And I was keeping an eye on it, wondering, like, is it going to home in on anyone in particular? So the heart was thumping a bit.
This afternoon, in the face of these marvellous books, we forced ourselves with difficulty to a conclusion.
When Lord Gowrie, the chair of the judges that year, got up and spoke. He said he'd be brief, and he was. It was great.
The winner of the 1993 Booker Prize for Fiction, the 25th, is Roddy Doyle for Paddy Clark.
And I heard my name. And it took a few seconds for me to realise, oh, I have to stand up and... A moment of huge satisfaction for me was that evening where I found a payphone and phoned my parents. And my parents were just wild with excitement, more so than I was. They were so thrilled, so delighted. And that was at the time a great feeling, but, you know, obviously with the years and the fact that they're no longer alive, that to me was probably the high point. My first novel, which I self-published, I needed a bank loan, and I could only get one if I had a guarantor, because I wasn't a property holder or anything like that. And my parents went guarantor, and they loved the fact that I was doing this. You know, I was writing. I think my father would have liked to have been an artist, you know. And so to make them happy, that was great.
Thank you.
Witness History was presented by Ben Henderson, and for more memorable moments from history told by the people who were there, search for Witness History on BBC Sounds. Now it's time for Tweet of the Day, produced by Sophie Anton and presented by the nature writer Sophie Pavel.
The Unmistakable Song of the Skylark. From Shakespeare to Wordsworth, from First World War battlefields to the present day, the lark is an iconic avian muse. A symbol of dawn, of new beginnings, of new love, and perhaps only rivaled by the nightingale in song. A red-listed species soundscaping the UK's uplands and coastlines, the skylark is famed for its display flight, a near-vertical climb of more than 300 metres. They would vanish from sight and earshot were it not for the music they pour into the air. Airborne, they hover effortlessly. Weighing little more than 30 grams, they can sing for minutes on end, liquid in their melody that almost tumbles from the sky before parachuting gently back to earth. A specialised respiratory system enables the impossible, to breathe and to sing at the same time. They are among our fastest declining birds, yet skylarks have soundtracked some of my most cherished memories. They are the voice of 5 a.m. on Dartmoor.